Call the House Interim Judiciary Committee to order.
Before we start, I want to remind those that are here that December 13th means we're going to adopt all the LC drafts. We're going to need to have a quorum on both the House and Senate sides, so let's do our best to get people here. Try to be here. If you're not going to be here, let staff know ahead of time if you get tied up.
Some of us have a different card.
We could always conference in, too.
Yeah, we can conference in during that time, so if you couldn't be here specifically for that part of it. We have one senator.
And you can refer this to what?
Any indication we're really engaged in the process? Thank you, Senator. We're going to start out right away this evening, this morning, excuse me. Greg Prinz, you want to come up now?
I'm leaving the room.
I've asked him to introduce his companion, because as far as I know, it was hodgepodge.
Thank you, Representative. For the record, Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission, and by prearrangement, I said I would introduce Devarshi Vajpai, who is the person that the Criminal Justice Commission relies on to coordinate the drug court grants. And Mr. Taylor asked me to, told me that today was a chance to kind of give an implementation update on this part of the meth package. And just to do some, to back up and give the context, you'll remember that House Bill 2485 was one half of what we called the meth package last session. And that bill gave responsibility for administering a drug court grant program to the Criminal Justice Commission. So it added that duty to our other duties of being a policy forum and running the sentencing guidelines. And so that bill passed, and then an accompanying budget, an appropriation was passed with that too last session. That was House Bill 5174. And that bill did two things. It put $1 million to continue funding for some operating drug courts that were in Benton County, Marion County, Malheur County, and Multnomah County. Those were drug courts that were run on a federal grant that was going away right then. So we, the decision, I think, was to continue those with this as part of the meth package. And then also there was a $2.5 million appropriation of grant money to the Criminal Justice Commission. And then were given the opportunity to send out those grants. And so one of the first things I did was find Devarshi. And Devarshi's been a counselor, a drug and alcohol counselor. He just got his MBA degree and has worked at the Department of Human Services as well. So he has a good background and understands treatment. And so I'm going to hand it off to him to let you know where we are with implementing those grants.
Representative Krieger, my name is Devarshi Vajpai. I'm with the Criminal Justice Commission, not Devarshi Hodgepodge. We're having some technical difficulties here. First, we want to start off with, like Craig mentioned, we had $2.5 million available for drug court grants when we started off. We worked with the Criminal Justice Services Division with the Oregon State Police to get an additional $1.5 million, actually a $3 million grant program that goes through the next biennium, so 2008. So we have $1.5 million available for 2006-07, so a total of $4 million. When we put the grant application out, we received those back in, I think, March or April, and we had about $10 million in requests. So it was what we were able to meet was a small portion of what was actually needed. You can see from the map that we tried to get some geographical diversity. One of the main reasons, or some of the main reasons that applications were denied or didn't receive funding were because they didn't adequately address evidence best practices. He had a high cost per individual served. Those are the two main reasons that we turned down applications. But clearly, most of the programs that applied for the grant were clearly showed a lot of merit and would have performed excellently. Combined totals between the burn grants and the CJC grants, you can see from this that Jackson County, Deschutes County, Marion County, and Washington County were the counties that received the greatest, largest grant funds. In many cases, that was because they were implementation grants rather than expansion, so they were building up the additional infrastructure to provide services, not just expanding services where infrastructure already existed. But some of the grants that were probably underfunded were include Lane and Klamath County. They received substantially less than they asked for, hopefully just to get services started there. These are really approximate numbers. We have about 1,000 people involved in drug courts per year at this point. We expect there to be about a 50% increase as a result of these grants. So it should be a fairly substantial increase in terms of the outcomes that we get from drug courts, which other people will be talking about later today. In terms of our grant funds, the CJC grant funds, and this doesn't apply to CJSD, the Criminal Justice Services Division grants, the vast majority of the grant money goes to treatment and supporting services, for example, housing, transportation vouchers, mental health treatment, so all those things that help people stay engaged in the program. County administration means the county employees that are going through the financial bookkeeping, reporting, that kind of stuff. It doesn't include our administration. Travel and training is very small. The coordinators, court coordinators, are a very important part of the drug court. They make sure that they are kind of the conduit between the judge and the treatment providers and other service providers. And so those make up a fairly substantial portion of the grant as well. We'll continue monitoring these grants pretty closely. The Chief Justice Advisory Committee on Treatment Courts worked with us to develop a set of performance measures for drug courts. These are some of the measures that are on the list of performance measures, and we're in the process of trying to develop some baselines for these right now. Recidivism, we measure recidivisms for this purpose as the number of, or percentage of, participants who are arrested for a felony or misdemeanor charge, or charged with a felony or misdemeanor in the year after graduation. Reduced use, graduation rate for parents, compliance. One of the things that we found is that clearly drug courts have a significant impact on compliance with treatment in court sessions. They're just much more likely to show up. One of the baseline measures that we've looked at, it looks like about 95% of treatment sessions are met, which is huge for a treatment provider. I mean, when I was a treatment provider, I would have loved to have that kind of compliance rate. The OTCMS, the data system that's managed by the Judicial Department, is how we track all these outcomes. OTCMS is the Oregon Treatment Court Management System. And we're going to use that to look at the effectiveness of these drug courts, but also I'll be visiting most of the programs, looking at how things are going. Like Craig mentioned earlier, I have been a treatment provider before. I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. I also, like Craig said, I have an MBA, so I can look at more of the financial side of things, too. For the burn grant recipients, they were required to set aside 10% of their grants for evaluation. So that is going to be a major part of us looking at how these grants are working. For the most part, the grants are being evaluated by outside evaluators, for example, in the MPC research, who they're going to be talking later today. And they're nationally known as for evaluating drug courts. Future direction, one of the things that I really want to do, and this is really vague at this point, is to develop performance-based contracts for the next biennium. I clearly don't want to reward results. Programs that are performing better than expected, I think, should be rewarded for that. We do have some major obstacles. For example, if we only look at graduation rates, programs can drive those up by cherry picking their clients, picking easy clients rather than the more difficult high risk ones. And so we want to avoid that. So there are some major obstacles to developing performance based contracts, but we are definitely looking at that right now. I turn it over to Craig.
The last thing I wanted to let you know was so far in the budgeting process, I think what to expect is you'll see that $2.5 million that you appropriated to me and the Criminal Justice Commission. And by the way, we had the commission. It was very helpful to have some outside people work with Devarshi and question what he was doing. I think it was a very successful format for that, to have the commission members do that. At any rate, in my essential budget, next biennium, I expect there'll be a $5 million continuation of those drug court grants, because the $2.5 million we used for 1 year. So just wanted to let you know that's, I think, the future budget-wise, and that would be to continue the ones that we've gotten started. So that's really all we had this morning. If you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer them. And I'm very excited that we have the folks from NPC here. I think they probably won't mention this, but I think Devarshi did. They are nationally recognized, and we have the advantage of having them here in Portland for evaluating drug courts. They do it all over the country. So I think that we'd very much like to work with them and work with the Judicial Department and the Department of Human Services and all the stakeholders in this to make sure we're, I think that the main theme I got from the during the session was, independently evaluate these drug courts and make sure that you allow enough local control for the counties to be creative but really track the outcomes. So that's what we hope we will be able to do in the future.
Greg, we need that investment dollars. How are you going to performance side from it? When you take those costs versus the cost of incarceration, the cost of treatment, and how many of those would have gone past the point where they were to be a more serious offender over time and come back to the process. Do you have any way of ever getting a handle around that type of evaluation, economic analysis?
Mr. Chair, I think one of the things that I'll answer that in two ways. I think one thing we can do is compare it to probation and the outcomes for that. That's one of the things that Dr. Finnegan did in Portland with the stop court. So you can compare it to a traditional probation, and Dr. Finnegan can talk about the cost effectiveness of that. The other thing that we're working on at the Criminal Justice Commission is really looking at getting a statewide estimate for a cost avoidance, meaning if we're saying, say, the drug court in Klamath County or the drug court in your county is reducing arrests by 35% or 50%, we need to be able to give some kind of cost estimate to what taxpayer savings that would mean. And then I agree with you, trying to get a long-term study of what that means as far as avoiding that conviction down the road. We'll work on that. That's a harder step to take. So I want to first focus on comparison to what we're doing, I guess, business as usual, and then make sure that the Criminal Justice Commission can have a uniform cost avoidance scheme that then we can work with. Really, I think that's what we hired an economist to do, and we want to work with NPC because they've done that in the past. So I think we can do that.
I think when we go to the Ways and Means process next session with this request, mm-hmm. we need to back up. Hey, that was a good investment. And another thing we need to be talking about is that is dollars. And how you measure the improvement in the lives of those people and their being a productive citizen and being in the workforce. And
exactly.
How do you measure that? You don't. Mm-hmm. We need to be talking about that at the same time. Committee members, what's it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank Craig and Devarshi for doing this. I mean, I think they hit a good mix of starting new programs and continuing the ones going on. Plus, I know I worked with them a lot on the fact that you had to give the counties enough money to have a success. So I think he did a good job of awarding the grants based upon needs and giving those counties a chance to succeed so we can measure. If they didn't have enough money, it's obvious they were going to fail. They had to have enough money to have opportunity. So I appreciate the effort that they did. My question to Craig is, I remember from the Ways and Means discussion, we wanted to get away from loading up the Criminal Justice Commission with jobs like this. Now, Devashi, I guess, is an extra slot, and do you think you're going to be able to handle this and still focus on your commission, because you've been sidetracked a lot from your primary mission?
Representative, that's a great question. Actually, the commission is meeting at noon today. I wanted them, to be here today, and we're going to talk about that. And I think we should talk about that again in Ways and Means, because I'm happy to do this. I think because drug courts are a great policy, and I was honored to be given this task, and I think the commission was as well, and it's a great thing for us to do. I also know that my main focus should be the cost effectiveness of the entire system, and sometimes what I worry about is my independence when I'm working with you. I want to make sure that it's awkward when I have a program that I'm administering and I'm also trying to evaluate its cost effectiveness, because I feel like suddenly I'm like any other person that comes to the legislature saying my program works, and I think that's the thing that I'm most concerned about. But I appreciate that question, because I think it's going to come up, and we're going to talk about it this afternoon with the commission. Thank you.
Representative, he does have weekends and
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, just looking at the map of the counties that made requests and those that didn't, I was struck by the few that did not, and most part they are rather rural counties, but actually one of them, the county that I live in and has two-thirds of my legislative district, is Clackamas County, which did not apparently apply for a grant. Is that because they don't have a drug court now and are not able to see a way of trying to move forward in that? What can you tell us about Clackamas County's need?
Representative McPherson, is it okay if I have Devashi answer, and I think we'll get a better answer?
Representative McPherson, we talked to Clackamas County a couple times. They have a very active drug court. Judge Seelander is one of the leaders in the drug court movement in Oregon. I think that one of their major concerns about when they decided not to apply was the sustainability of funds. They didn't want to apply for a grant for 1 year and not know what was going to happen 2 years down the road. But they didn't want to ramp up a program and then have to shut it down afterwards. So I think that was one of their major concerns when they were looking at applying for the grant.
Follow up if I could, Mr. Chair. What does that suggest to us about what may be happening in other counties where they had existing drug courts? Is there, when I see the population figures offenders being served, which went up by half again, is there a major sort of backfilling process going on here? That is, grants that are being made to counties with existing drug courts that are then able to free up funds that they can use then for other judicial operations.
Representative McPherson, to the extent that we could, we looked at making sure that they avoided that. They had to clearly demonstrate that they were increasing their population in the drug court, not that they were serving the population that was currently there. So as much as we could, we avoided that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Next item, evaluating drug courts, Michael Finnegan and Shannon Carey. Welcome to the committee. I apologize for being late. I got held up for 20 minutes, a half a mile from my house.
Oh, yes.
Just this huge traffic jam up of some sort. I do want to welcome you to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. And please give your names for the
sure. Committee. I'm Mike Finnegan, the president and founder and owner of NPC Research. This is to my left is Dr. Shannon Carey and my staff. Craig had thought that I would be too modest to mention anything about MPC research, because I was wrong about that. I do need to want to do a little bit of introduction to the company so you understand the data that we are about to present and where it comes from. I founded this company about almost 17 years ago now up in Portland. We've done a lot of Oregon work. We did a lot of work for many years and still do. But we've become a national firm at this point. We have a branch on the East Coast. And we got into, I was one of the early researchers in drug court research, and I'm currently on the National Research Advisory Committee for Drug Court Performance Measures. And I dragged Shannon and others into drug court research fairly early. We've evaluated, I think, about 40, or in the middle of the night, about 40. See, she knows, I don't know, 45 to 50 drug courts around the country at this point who either have evaluated or are evaluating. We then develop a cost approach, and I think that's the part that we particularly want to present to you today, because I began to feel that the cost approach is very important to policymakers, and we're going to explain a little bit about that. We are currently doing a cost approach in the state level in Michigan. Michigan, Minnesota, Maryland, we like M states apparently, Indiana, California, and Guam. Am I missing anything?
No, except the one in Guam isn't a cost thing.
Oh, that's true. Okay. Anyway, that's so that there that you'll understand a little bit about the fact we have data from all over the country. That's our data. That's stuff that we have done. And the cost approach that we're using is being used by now by a number of different states to do the cost analysis. So with that, I'll start, although I had this is where we're going to go with this presentation. We were going to describe what a drug court is. I have a feeling that I'm going to go through that quickly because it sounds like you all know what a drug court is, so we wouldn't have to spend much time on that. Shannon's going to talk, go back for a second, Shannon. Shannon's going to talk about drug court outcomes. Then I'm going to talk about our cost-benefit approach, and she's going to do the methodology, and then I'm going to do some of the results to show you where it can go. Okay? Well, the purpose of a drug court is to guide offenders identified as drug addicted into treatment, and that will reduce their dependence and improve the quality of life for offenders and their family. That's the goal, anyway. Keep going, please. The main goals are reducing recidivism, reducing substance use, and improving family, community, and individual functioning. And let me pause on that. Those are the key goals. There are some other things that are important, sub-goals. It depends on the drug court. Some drug courts emphasize employment and getting people heavily employed. Others, juvenile drug courts particularly emphasize education, school. Family drug courts emphasize getting the parental unification if possible. So there are different goals that happen, but these are the primary ones to go for. I might briefly go through the 10 key components. The National Association of Drug Court Professionals and the National Drug Court Institute developed these as standards for drug courts. These are the things, the 10 key things we think should go into a drug court. Let me just quickly go through, because I think you may know some of these already. Drug courts integrate alcohol and other drug treatment services with the justice system case processing. To me, this is the most exciting thing. I got into this research. This is one of the most exciting things about drug court, because rarely do you have programs that involve such a combination of such a team approach among people that wouldn't ordinarily work together all that well sometimes. The public defender, the district attorney, treatment providers, the criminal justice system, a drug court judge. It's a remarkable integration of a number of different aspects of both the criminal justice system and the treatment system. It uses a non-adversarial approach and promoting public safety while protecting participants' due process rights. That's an important issue. Eligible participants are identified early and promptly placed in the drug court. That's a critical. Remember, these are components we think are critical to a successful drug court. So one of the performance measures that we want, do you get people identified early and into the drug court program? We provide a continuum of alcohol, drug, and other related treatment and rehabilitation services. Again, that's a question that we try to measure. Are they actually doing that? Abstinence is monitored by frequent alcohol and other drug testing. A coordinated strategy governs drug court responses to participants' compliance. Ongoing judicial interaction with each drug court participant is essential. Let me just pause on that. I think one of the critical elements of a drug court as opposed to a traditional court is in a traditional courtroom setting, the judge interacts primarily with the attorneys present. And in a drug court setting, in most cases, the drug court judge interacts primarily with the offender and becomes heavily involved in understanding their lives. And that, for many offenders, that's a remarkable thing, to have a judge interested in their lives. I think that may be one of the key elements in understanding why drug courts succeed or fail. Monitoring, evaluation, measure the achievement of program goals, engage their effectiveness. Continuing interdisciplinary education, promoting effective drug court planning, implementation, and operations, and then, perhaps the most important, forging partnerships among drug courts, public agencies, and community-based organizations, generating local support and enhancing drug court effectiveness. Those are the 10 key components that are considered essential to an effective drug court. Now I'm going to let Shannon, Dr. Carey, has actually done much of the drug court research herself, that we, of all those 45, I think certainly the vast majority you've actually conducted. So I'm going to let her talk about, first of all, the outcome results of drug courts, and then I'll come back and talk to you about cost approach.
Okay, before you move on, I just wanted to welcome Judge Graves, who's now sitting behind you, walked in. As you went through the 10 key components, I think most of us have actually attended drug court proceedings, and I personally attended Judge Graves' drug court proceedings, and we have seen these components work on the ground. In fact, Judge Graves, when the courthouse had a catastrophe about a year ago, Judge Graves has actually been running the Marion County court, a drug court in the Capitol, and so it's given more of an opportunity for people to actually watch the magic that is done in these courts. So thank you for that.
Before we go on, I did go through that fast because I have a feeling that you have already heard it.
Yeah.
But if you have any questions about any of those things, please ask.
And while I'm speaking, please feel free to ask questions as I go, so don't feel like you have to wait.
Wanted to give that little editorial comment before we move on.
Right.
Welcome, Judge Graves.
And also, before I go into it, since Judge Graves is here, there's actually a few results that I'm going to be presenting on your drug court, so all very positive.
You're welcome to jump up, Judge Graves, if they do you wrong on any of this.
So far, I feel very comfortable.
Okay, so first I was just going to show you some of the variety of what kinds of participants go to drug court. There's some things that are very similar about them. They all tend to be in their 30s. It's a little bit older population. It actually means that it's also a little bit more criminal. That doesn't show in this table, but the older people tend to have a longer criminal history. So on average, what we're finding across pretty much every site that I've studied is at least in the last 2 years, there's at least two prior arrests before they get to drug court, and then the rest of their history, they can have up to 30 arrests in their past before they even get to drug court. They're primarily male. There's all different ethnic groups that have successfully gone through drug court, so you can see the variety. You know, in Guam, it's almost entirely the native population, and anywhere from white, Hispanic, African American, and other sites. The drug of choice also is a big variety, and all of them seem to do really well in the drug court setting. Methamphetamine in particular, the drug court setting seems to be particularly good for methamphetamine users because it really forces them, basically it coerces them into getting to treatment long enough that they can start having some of the physical changes and healing happen to the point where they can actually respond to treatment. So as you can see in Guam, the where we're seeing the most meth use is in coastal areas. So Guam, of course, is almost entirely coast. It's a very small island, and it's 90% meth use. In California, you've got some of the coastal areas having really high meth use, but Stanislaus is a county in California, also has really high. In Oregon, in Portland in particular, it's climbing, but it's not a huge piece yet, but it's getting there. Okay, so I'm just going to show kind of a random sampling of results that we found in different states. In California, we looked at 9 sites simultaneously, and on average, we're finding a 52% retention rate. Some 4 of the 9 sites had greater than 65% retention. What we mean by retention is that they stay in the program long enough to graduate, basically. So they continue for at least a year in the program. And national data from the TEDS database, it's a treatment database that's nationally gathers data all over the nation. Finding outpatient treatment, 35% is the average. So drug courts clearly show a better retention rate. Lower recidivism rates. Of course, that's one of the biggest things that drug courts are trying to do their goal.
Gotcha. You want to take questions during
that? Yeah, please. Sorry.
Thank you. We talked in our drug court in Deschutes County about the fact that even though we have one now coming on board, we got more demand than we have capability. So you talk about attendance rates. Do you have a guideline that if they don't show up the first, if they miss 1 out of 3 or something, in other words, I want to get them out of it if we're not going to be able to cure them soon. Do you have any guidelines? You can discuss that about how you get them out and get someone in that wants to be helped?
That's often a balance that the drug courts are trying to decide. How much do you continue to put resources into somebody who's not going to graduate versus, getting people who you think are going to make it through? What we've actually found is that the drug courts that keep people longer, that keep trying and understand that drug use and drug addiction is something that takes some time, that there's going to be relapses, there's going to be some struggle, particularly at the beginning, that if they hang on to that person, they tend to have better outcomes as far as their recidivism later. And then, of course, if you have lower recidivism, you have lower costs. So far, what we found, if they have low graduation rates because they drop people immediately if they're not working, their outcomes don't look as good for either group. The graduates always look good. Of course, it's John Goldkamp is a researcher that does a lot of drug court research, and his phrase that we often quote is, how surprising is it that succeeders succeed and failures fail? So if you look, of course the graduates are going to look good, but the more people you have graduate, the better your outcomes. So if you can hang on to people, keep them in the program, and find ways to pull them back when they don't show up, the second they don't show up for treatment, the treatment provider should be calling the judge or the coordinator or somebody on the team and saying, so-and-so didn't show up today, and they go out and find them and get them back in there. And that's what keeps people engaged in, in the program long enough to get engaged, even if they weren't at the beginning. Does that answer your question at all?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm not an expert, but I think it's a real problem, and that you got the people waiting to come in, and maybe that person, I think there should be some commitment on the person to make some sort of attendance, but I'm not anywhere near an expert, so I'm just asking, is there data out there to help our court, drug court, empirical data this?
One of the other issues with drug court research has been the concern that what drug courts are doing is what is called creaming, which is just cherry picking, however you want to say that, just getting the best people, the ones who would do well anyway, and selecting those and trying to get those to graduation. I think what Shannon's saying from really the extensive number of drug courts that she's evaluated is that it isn't necessarily true that you can make that decision early on. You know what I mean? You think you can say, oh, well, this person's going to be good and this person is not. But those people, the judges that do that, don't necessarily get better results down the road. That the judges that say, one of the strengths of drug court is to engage people. I mean, they may not be motivated when they come in, or they may have all kinds of issues, but that's the strength of drug court, is that it engages people and keeps them going. And from a research point of view, we like that too, because it isn't cherry picking, it is trying to take, and in some of these courts that she has studied, these are pretty serious cases and pretty tough cases, and they're success.
And we have looked at courts where the judge won't allow somebody in unless they admit they have a problem and are willing to work on it. And then we have courts that take anybody. So the Multnomah County Drug Court in Portland, the stop court, takes anybody. It's whoever comes in, if they have a problem or not, they get referred, they get in the program. And their outcome results, as you'll see in some of these slides coming up, are very, very positive. And the sites where they don't allow them in don't have any better results. The ones that allow only people who say they have a problem don't have better results. So I just have to tell a really quick story. We have this videotape of a participant who graduated and talks about his experience getting into the program. He didn't want to go to the drug court program, and his lawyer told him he was a serious heroin addict, and they found him, arrested him. He was living in his car. They dragged him out, took him down to the jail, and his lawyer sat with him and told him about drug court. Said, you know, if you go through this program, this arrest and felony will go off your record, and you can, you know, teach you how to operate without drugs. And he was like, well, maybe. And they said, and you have to go to treatment every day, and you have to go to before the judge. And he said, see ya. That was the end of that. And then the judge said, or then the lawyer said, or you could go to prison for a couple years. And he said, maybe I'll try the drug court program. And he did not want to go. He had no interest in going off drugs, but the court did, you know, coerce him to the point where he finally engaged himself, and he graduated and got a job and has a real life and got his kids back. And so it's not always about whether the person thinks that they're ready to be engaged at the time. That's, as Mike said, it's the strength of a drug court, is that it coerces people into it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shannon, yep. Dr. Curie. There seems to be, Judge Graves and I, we've talked about this before over the past few months and everything, especially when he's here in Capitol. And having worked closely with the District Attorney's Association and everything, I'm curious your thoughts or are interested. There seems to be somewhat of a battle going on back between the drug courts and that of releasing the authority or the power over a suspect or an offender from the DAs, realizing that they have to relinquish their authority over them.
Mm-hmm.
The thought is, how many times does the offender jump off the bandwagon and still get through the program? I'm interested in your thoughts. Is there an exact number that should be out there? Is it kind of situational leadership type thing?
I don't know if you'll like this answer, but honestly, I think it's really personal. I mean, it's the judge and their feel for that particular person and their circumstances, and is this somebody that we should keep investing time and resources in? Yeah, I know that, you know, they've used 4 times in the last 3 months when, you know, they're coming back through again. What's, you know, sometimes they're, and I've had lots of, we talked with the, part of our methods is to talk with the participants, and we talked with lots of participants who said, if it hadn't been for the judge giving me that one more chance, I wouldn't be alive today. You know, and so it's that, you know, it's really a balance. There's some people you can just say that this guy's not going to get engaged, and then there's other people you just, you know, you just want to give him one more chance, and sometimes that makes the difference. And I know that one of the judges in Portland had a situation where he did not put the person in jail, even though he felt like, you know, he kicked him out of the program instead of saying, you know, you got another dirty UA, you need to go sit in jail. Instead, he kicked him out, and that night the person went and put his head on the max tracks. And so, you know, obviously he has a bias at this point to keeping people in the program. So, I'm sorry, I can't answer that more carefully, but there isn't clear research on it a number of times.
Actually, may I say something? Actually, that's an interesting point that you've raised. I mean, we actually would have the ability to look back and say the average time across a number of courts, and I think that's something we should do. We haven't done it yet, but yeah, we should do it. But also, I would want to say one of the things we have discovered over all these different drug courts is there are no two drug courts exactly alike. They all follow some general principles, but judges run their drug courts the way they feel is best to run them, and so decisions about, you know, how long to keep someone in the program, how much how quickly to use jail as a sanction, those kinds of things vary all over the place. Now, one of the strengths of our methods is that ultimately we should be able to say back to the individual judge, you know, relative to other people, your method produces better outcomes, more cost-effective outcomes to the taxpayer, or yours doesn't. You see what I mean? That's what we're moving toward, and putting all this, all these different ones that we've studied together. We're not quite there. Well, you'll see some of what we have done there. But we're hoping to not go beyond the question of the drug courts work, but also our best practices.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions?
In the 9 sites, and once again, this is a California example, in those 9 sites, 17% of the graduates, and this is 4 years after entering the program, 17% of the graduates have been rearrested. 29% of all participants, whether they graduated or not, compared to the comparison group, were 41%. So clearly, drug court, whether you graduate or not, has some effect on how you do later in life. It's not just the graduates that can do well. So having some dose of this treatment is helpful. Just another example over the years of how what the graph generally looks like is in the first year, you know, the number, it grows over time, but the comparison group, the pink line, obviously they continue to recidivate more and more over time. I just wanted to give a quick juvenile drug court. This is actually the Clackamas County Juvenile Drug Court. One of you asked about Clackamas. They have an excellent juvenile drug court program. It's one of my model programs when I talk to juvenile drug courts about their practices. The Clackamas Juvenile Drug Court, Judge Darling is just, you know, right on the top of the literature, the best things to do for their participants. And they, as you can see, have very positive results. The graduates, the pink line again, are quite low in their recidivism 2 years after, and all participants do well, and they get rearrested about half or less than half as often as people in the comparison group are kids that were similar. Basically, they were eligible for drug court but didn't go, partly because some of their counselors, juvenile counselors who do the referring, don't really always support the drug court program, so they just don't think of sending their kids over there. So they're basically the same kids, have all the same background, and just weren't sent to the drug court program. And you can see that they continue to reoffend quite a bit more over time if they don't go to the drug court program.
Okay, Senator Vasquez, you have a question?
Yes,
thank you. I was going to ask, based on this slide and the one that you had on drug court participants lowered recidivism rates, you didn't have a time frame as to when that was done for the adults. Could you tell us what type of time frame? Was that a 24-month period or a 36-month period?
Are we talking about this one?
It was, yes.
Yes, that was 4 years.
4 years.
Over 4 years.
Thank you.
This one, again, is over 4 years. It's from, this slide comes from the same data set as that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so one of the other goals of drug court is to reduce drug use, and one of the ways we measure that is to look at the number of positive tests they have over time. So this is Marion County, Judge Graves, and you can see that in the first 3 months they have some relapses, and then their drug use over time clearly decreases in the program. It's just, this is their percent of positive drug tests, so clearly this is, it's doing something. They're using less. And just on the topic, you know, drug tests are one of the key components. And when I talk to participants about what's one of the key things that keeps you not using, they'll say, I know I'm going to get tested. So when they first start, it's really not about, I really want to stay off drugs. It's, I'm going to get caught. And that's one of the strengths of the drug court program, is that they do catch it. And then another measure of whether they're using again is drug-related rearrests. Are they rearrested for possession or other drug-related? And the comparison group is the pink one, the hot pink, and then the pale blue is the drug court group. And you can see at 12 months, this is Marion County again, about half is likely to be rearrested for a drug-related offense.
Oh, and there was one thing I was forgetting in there. We also do we're doing a national cross-site study of the family drug courts for SAMHSA, for CSA actually. And I thought I'd just quickly talk about family drug courts. But I think that's something that you would have interest in as well. They're also known as family drug courts, family treatment courts, family dependency courts. They're given all sorts of names, but they're basically using the drug court model with offenders that are substance abusers, substance abusing parents that have child welfare complaints against them, and their children, or whether their children will be united or not, is a question. The need for effective services, obviously with ASFAL, I don't know how much you know about that, but the adoption of the Safe Families Act mandated essentially both time elements and essentially providing effective services for those with substance abusers and had child welfare issues. The goal is to increase positive treatment outcomes and therefore increase the probability of successful reunification and also to maintain the safety and well-being of a child. They are similar to adult drug courts. They have increased judicial oversight. They're supportive. They have a structured environment. They integrate drug court team. An integrated drug court team provides support and wraparound services. They're accessible and have appropriate treatment resources, and they have relapse support. The difference from adult drug court is that they're, first of all, predominantly women. Shannon was showing you that adult drug courts are predominantly male for a variety of obvious reasons. Family drug courts are predominantly the mother trying to get her child back. The threat is different in the family drug court than is in the adult drug court. In the family drug court, is termination of parental rights is the main threat. That's what keeps people in the program. Also, they must address family system issues and child safety concerns. And successful treatment doesn't necessarily mean successful reunification. You could be good at, you could get the substance abuse under control, but still not get your child back. That's a possibility. Let me just quickly give you some summaries of what we're just concluding the last analysis on this study. It's been going on for, I think now, this is 5 years. We're into 5 years now, but we're actually going to write a report here. So, and so we're just about done. But let me give you some quick results here. First of all, on treatment issues, we're a very significant result. They're more likely to enter treatment. They enter treatment faster than the comparison group. They spend more days in treatment than the comparison group, and they have more treatment completion. So we're very clear treatment outcomes for their family drug court. We looked at courts across the nation. And in the child welfare results, there were more reunifications of family drug court members, and there were fewer terminations of parental rights. I might mention something very quickly that was an interesting finding. The feds, had, in their infinite wisdom, had thought that it would also reduce the amount of time until a permanency decision is made. That was one of the variables they wanted us to measure. Turns out that there's no difference between the comparison group and the family drug court on that issue. In other words, they don't get to a family or a decision for termination of parental rights or not any quicker with the family drug court. But the drug court judges say, no, of course not. I mean, for instance, I'm starting to work with this mother, beginning to see some progress. I'm not going to come to a quick decision just yet. I'm going to delay it a little bit. So it makes sense from the point of view of what they do. Quickly, these outcomes, I think you can get a sense of the difference between the family drug court and the comparison group. Time to enter treatment, you see how much quicker the family drug court gets people into treatment.
Excuse me, Bill Finnegan.
Sure, Mr. Finnegan, we're talking about family drug courts. I think you said it reduces the length of time they spend in foster care of the kids and less likely to have termination of parental rights. Is that
right? Actually, in one of the sites in San Diego, we did a cost study on foster care costs, and that was true in San Diego. But if I said that about them all, we haven't done it on them all. We've just done it in San Diego.
The original implications is that it saves quite a bit of money as it relates to foster care.
Yes. Yeah. Probably, yes. As a researcher, I can only say in San Diego, where we studied it, it did.
Okay.
I can't tell about the other sites.
Would you say those costs are substantially more than the cost of drug court?
You know, we haven't done that analysis yet. We did the analysis on the foster care costs only because that's what SAMHSA would pay us to do. We would like to do a cost study on family drug courts, but we have not yet found a funder to do that. You'll see in the adult setting we have done many, and you'll see those results, and the answer for that is yes, but in the family drug court, I don't know yet. Sorry, buddy.
What's your guess?
My guess is that they probably do offset the crossing. given the experience, and you'll see our experience with adult, it's a little mixed, but you'll see it, and it's the same sort of thing I think is going to happen in family care. That's the slide coming up.
And treatment is less expensive than foster care, so I think that there's a high likelihood if you've got people spending less time in foster care, that that cost savings will offset the cost of treatment for the parent.
Right.
So.
And again, the other two rows there, you can see where days in treatment is substantially higher, and completion of treatment is also substantially higher. Okay, now we're getting to the drug court costs. I think that may be the most interesting part of it to you. We, after having done quite a bit of process and outcome evaluation in drug courts, decided that the cost issue was a critical one for policymakers. And given the impact of the drug courts potentially on a whole variety of systems, there was a substantial possibility for cost avoidance to the taxpayer if we examined it. I probably don't need this slide. I mean, why do cost analysis? Policymakers face tremendous challenges, and certainly in providing cost-effective public services. Limited financial resources require difficult decisions to be made about resource allocation. I'm telling you this, I mean, you know this. Cost-benefit analysis is an effective tool to help with these decisions. We structure our cost-benefit approach to help answer the following questions. Which policies and programs are cost-beneficial to the taxpayer? And I might say that we do that by drug court. It isn't an all or nothing. The one thing that we have found over all these drug courts doing cost analysis is that there are no two drug courts alike. And it's not that all drug courts do one thing. We find the majority, you're going to see the majority of drug courts have very positive results. You're going to find a few that don't. We're going to find some that have more and some that have less. And wouldn't you expect that, since the drug courts are different in terms of how they run and how they don't? How cost-effective are alternative programs? What are the hidden costs in existing programs? Which expenditures provide taxpayers with the best return on their money? That's probably the $64,000 question. Probably worth more than that. And how much does everyday business as usual actually cost in time and resources? This last one is going to be a very interesting one. I'll get to that slide in a second. But one of the things that has surprised people in the court system when we've done our approach is how much business as usual costs the system. That's what you don't take into account. When I started doing this cost research, the drug court judges were saying, don't do it, it'll be too expensive, I don't like it, all that stuff. And what has surprised even us is when you compare it to taking those folks and not putting them through drug court, but putting them through business as usual, how expensive that is to the taxpayer to do business as usual. We'll get to that in a second.
Did you have a control group that was equal when you made this analysis?
Right. In all cases, we don't have the ability to do random assignments. It's very hard to get judges to be willing to do a random assignment to conditions for reasons that you might expect. All our comparison groups are matched comparison groups, which is that we identify people who are eligible for drug court, but did not go for a variety of reasons, not just motivational reasons, but things like transportation issues. One of our favorites is there's a set of attorneys that don't like drug courts and they don't recommend them. That's kind of a random factor there. Then we match them on characteristics, criminal history, gender, drug treatment history, all kinds of things to try to make them an equivalent comparison group. We use something called propensity score matching lately, which is a technique that helps get as close to random assignment as you're going to get with a non-random assignment trial.
So you controlled, getting back to Representative Poisonet's point about, some people are easier than others, you controlled so that you wouldn't have the easy people being measured as drug court people and the harder people being measured as business as usual.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we are very adamant on, sometimes the drug court judges don't like us for this, but, the drug court judges want us just to analyze graduates. They say, those are the ones we really had an effect on, just use those. But we can't do that methodologically because we couldn't figure out who among the comparison group might go through anyway and do well. See what I mean? Although Shannon will show graduates just for your information, our comparison is always all the participants participants in drug court, where they dropped out a month later, or whoever they were, you know. And the judges will say, but if they dropped out a month, you know, then I didn't get an impact. Why are you counting them? Why are you counting them? Well, we're counting them because they went that route. From the policymaker's point of view, we sent that person to drug court. And so we have to fairly compare drug court to those that sent in the other direction. And that's what we do.
I can just add to that, that we have a tendency when we do our comparison groups and match them to if the... We always have them be not statistically significantly different, but if they are different, it tends to be that the drug court group is just a tiny bit more criminal than the comparison group. That's how it often comes out, not because we deliberately made it that way, but because it just seems like the drug court group does tend to be a little bit worse than the population in general. So we're actually finding the reverse of the cherry picking going on.
Yeah, we actually had surprises too. I think you could
do it.
Oh, okay.
I was going to do that.
Okay.
But I can do
that.
Okay, I'm going to.
Can I just follow up on that?
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't it make sense, though, when you think about it, in many of these cases, this last chance when you get in the drug court, and so this is the last chance they're going to have or they're away. And so I can see why you would see a tilting of more criminality in that subset.
Right. And that depends, one of the reasons that drug courts are different is that they have different policies about who they let in.
Right.
So in some cases, it's their last chance. In other cases, they only take first-time offenders. So that depends. You know, and then you end up with the first-time offender group actually having offenses that they missed. You realize that it's not really their first offense. But, yeah, there's a variety. But definitely in a lot of cases, it's this or prison. And then, yeah, it is more...
You know, I mean, just methodologically to talk to this. I mean, the ideal study would be is if we had a good readiness for change or motivation assessment that we could give to people, both those who go into drug court and those who don't, before they go in, then we could assess the degree to which, you know, the people more ready to change, more motivated, might be going into drug court. Frankly, you know, we've been looking for that instrument. Every instrument has its problems, and a lot of the few studies that have been done on that have been kind of inconclusive, I think. So our feeling is more, as what Shannon said, is that it doesn't sure seem like that drug courts are cherry-picking. I mean, there may be a few that are, but there's some that are really looking at really the harder cases in some ways.
When we've asked, you know, the treatment providers who deal with the people, the participants that come in, if these are people who want to change their lives and are ready to take, you know, ready to accept treatment, they'll laugh. Like, they don't want to be there. Those first few treatment sessions, they don't want to be there. Majority of the time choose it because it gets them out of jail. They can, even if it's only a couple weeks, you know, like it's 2 weeks in jail, or you can go to treatment and get out now. And it's all about right now, you know, which is an addict mentality of instant gratification. And so they'll choose that and then realize they got themselves into something a lot more intensive than just spending 2 weeks in jail, and now it's too late.
Sandra,
thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, isn't addiction primarily based on denial anyway? Denial that they have a problem, denial that this is going to hurt us.
Very.
And isn't that what you have to get by in order to get them into the program?
Well, get them engaged in the program. You can get them in the program and they're not engaged until they've been off drugs long enough that they can start thinking a little more clearly. But, well, you're absolutely right. While they're on it, they don't have an issue. They feel great. As soon as they go off, they don't feel so good anymore. And then it's back to either take the drug again to feel better, or, you know, they're going to catch me so I can't, and it sucks.
Okay, let's move back to the cost issue.
Oh, okay, so I'm going to try and quickly give you a little bit of a crash course in how we do our methodology so that you can understand where we're getting these costs. And then Mike, because he's the boss, gets to present the results, which is the fun part. So, first of all, we look at costs and benefits. There's a difference between a cost-effectiveness study and a cost-benefit study. Cost-effectiveness looks at the cost of the program and then looks at things like recidivism. You know, did it reduce recidivism by a certain amount? Cost and benefit looks at the cost of the program and the cost of the outcomes and looks to see, was there, you know, for every dollar you put in the program, what was the return? So we tend to do cost-benefit whenever we can because it's a little bit more meaningful as far as, you know, how many dollars do I have left over when I'm done? And one of the things that we look at in that cost-benefit approach is something that we call opportunity resources. What we often find, the example that we like to use is that if you talk to the sheriff at the jail and you say, hey, look at how much money you saved because drug court participants didn't come back through, and they'll say, my budget's the same, my cells are still full, I don't see any difference. And so our answer to that is that we've created a situation where somebody else is in those bids. You've had the opportunity to use that resource somewhere else instead of on a drug offender. So that's an opportunity resource that you're creating, not necessarily an exact savings. And then I have to tell a little story in California where we found the biggest savings was in the prison system. For every participant who went through drug court, they saved $3,000 in prison costs. And so what the legislature decided was to take the money from the prison and put it in drug courts. You can imagine how happy the prisons were about that.
We're staying out of California.
No, actually, they just won't give us data anymore. Yeah. So, and I'm not joking, they won't give us data.
The
correction system won't give us any more data because it didn't work out well for them.
That happens in Oregon, let us know.
So, on the surface that makes sense, but once again with opportunity resources, the prison may still be full, and taking the budget away wasn't necessarily, you know, the best way to do it, but it made sense to them at the time.
Can I just say about that, in fact, the California legislature always made its basis of its money for corrections on the number of people that would be put in there, so when they saw that, they moved that money over.
Did you have that? Okay. The other thing that we focus on is the cost of the taxpayer approach. So there's a lot of different costs. You could go on forever finding costs that, you know, cost to the individual, cost to the... economists have a lot of different ways to look at it, and we've tried to narrow it down to what's relevant to policymakers, and that's cost to the taxpayer. So it's public funds only is what we look at. And then finally we use what's called a transactional cost analysis approach, and that's the idea of looking at the system as, you know, every time an individual interacts with the system, resources change hands. It's a transaction. Just like if we go to McDonald's and buy a hamburger, there's a transaction that happens where somebody, you're paying for not only the burger, but the person behind the counter and the facilities and all the things that happen for that transaction. But the basis for all that was that one moment when I went in and ordered a hamburger. So it's the same thing with the drug court participants. They come in and their interaction with the system happens in different areas. They have the interaction with the judge in court, so that's one transaction. Then they have an interaction with treatment providers. They have an outpatient session, a group session, that's one transaction. They have an individual session, that's another transaction. So we look at all the transactions added together to get the cost. Okay, so quickly the steps through. First thing that we do is we go through and determine what the flow or the process is in the court so that we can find out what those transactions are. The way you do that is basically through a process evaluation. You go through and you do interviews, you observe the court, you review their documents, and do the same thing for business as usual. How does this work? The most intensive study we've done doing this was in Multnomah County. We came with stopwatches, literally, and we followed participants. We got access to OGIN in the office, and we go in and say, oh, somebody was arrested on a possession charge, and we go to their arraignment and time. How much time did it take them to do the arraignment? Did they go to the petition hearing for drug court? How much time was that? And they went and met with the public defender. We followed the public defender's office and sat outside the door and saw how long they talked to the public defender. And then we did the same thing. They went to court. Every time they went to court, we were there. Whether they went to business as usual or if they went to the drug court, we followed them to every hearing that they had.
We don't do that anymore. That was crazy. I'm glad we did it once.
Well, we did it once to make sure that we really understood the true resources that were being used. And it gave us a really good idea of how the drug court operated. And we literally followed them around, so we were a participant. We knew exactly what was happening at every step. Okay. Interviews with group, document review. One of the benefits of process evaluation is not only helping us with cost, it's also giving us useful information about how the program functions, what we can do to help improve the program, where it was inefficient, where it was efficient. And if we can give them good feedback on their process, then they can have better outcomes, and better outcomes mean better cost benefits. Okay, then once you understand how the program works, then you can find where all those transactions are. Okay, they met with the judge, they met with the public defender, they went to treatment, they had drug tests, there was a rearrest, jail, a stay in jail is a transaction. Okay, then you have to figure out what resources went into each of those transactions. The drug court hearing is the most complex example because everybody goes to the drug court hearing. You have police officers there, the public defender. It's different in every court, but in those courts, that's where everybody gathers. Treatment comes to talk to the judge, to tell them how the person's doing in treatment. The case manager will be there to talk about whether they're showing up for their probation, probation meetings. The public defender and the DA are there to make sure that they have their input on what happens with that person. So all that goes into a drug court hearing.
Can I just quickly interrupt you and just say, again, we're also doing this with a comparison group on the other side. So what we're getting is a very interesting picture for the system, not only what it really costs to put on a drug court. I mean, using all the resources, is the bail there, is it not there, that kind of thing. But we're also giving a picture of what business as usual is like, which oftentimes many systems don't have. So we kind of have a dual benefit here. They learn about the system and how it works. We also learn how a drug court works relative to that.
Okay, and then, so once you've figured out who's involved in each transaction, you have to figure out how much of their resources for every agency that's there, how much of their resources going into each of these transactions. So you talk to them about their time spent preparing for and then in participating in each of those transactions, and then how many transactions are there, how many program transactions happen, how many rearrests happen, how much time in jail. So you can multiply the cost of each transaction by the number of them to get the total cost. Okay. Part of that step is basically, that's what an outcome evaluation or an impact evaluation is looking at all those, every time they get rearrested, that not only feeds into our cost approach, it also tells us what are the outcomes for participants in the comparison group. And then, of course, the benefits to do that is the program effective? Did it have the intended outcomes? And what program characteristics, because we did the process evaluation, we know what the program is like, and we can say which of those characteristics led to those outcomes. And then we collect all that information mostly from administrative databases. What we found by following people around is that we had, firsthand knowledge of this is how many times this person really did go to the drug court. And then we would ask the judge, how many times do you think people go to drug court on average? How many times do they come before you? And then we went to the administrative database and we saw how many times were recorded. And we were trying to figure out what's the least intensive approach we could use to get good information on these things that were happening. And we found that people's opinion wasn't so good. Usually the judge would say, probably 50 times. And then we'd look in the administrative database and it would be 30 times. And then if you look at, actually going, it was around 30 times. So the administrative database set was really very effective in capturing the amount of resources that were being used. And it's much less intensive than following people around with stopwatches. Okay, so as I said, for each transaction, you're paying not just for the service itself, but also there's the direct cost, but there's the support costs, all the support people that go into it, and then there's the institutional overhead costs of just having a building available, and lights, power, heating, everything. So it's a fully loaded cost, what we call. And then finally, the last step is that we calculate the cost results, and we break it down in different ways. We have the investment cost, that's the cost in the program, and the cost of business as usual for that case that would have led to drug court. The net investment is the difference between those two. And then outcome costs, we separate out the investment costs, and then what happens after is outcome costs. And the net outcome cost is the difference between the drug court group and the comparison group. All right, and now Mike gets to do the fun part.
Yeah. So I'm going to show you some of the results here. And kind of give you a feel for why this has some value. I mean, we're doing a lot of work, admittedly, so it should pay off, hopefully, and we'll see how it does. Investment costs, of course, are the costs for the case that she just said, and the net investment costs are the difference between what it costs to put on drug court versus business as usual. That's an important concept to understand. If we just simply said, people ask us, how much does it cost to put on drug court? And we just looked at the drug court costs, we have this big number. What you wouldn't know is that a savings to the taxpayer, is it more, what is it, because you don't know the cost of business as usual. By looking at business as usual, we get the net cost. The net cost is, you put people through drug court, how much more does it cost to go through drug court than processing by business as usual? Well, this is the Portland, Oregon results, and when we did this one, this is one of the costs is quite a bit of surprise, and we did this for our National Institute of Justice. We've seen this actually happen several other times. It's not normal, it's not typical, but it does happen, and that is, if you can see, if you know enough about budgeting, to see the parentheses figure there, what that means is that it actually costs less to put a client through drug court, just in investment costs, than it did to process them in Multnomah County in business as usual. That you save money just by having the drug court. Forget outcome costs. You save money in Multnomah County by just having a cost. The net cost was actually the savings for the taxpayer to do that. Now,
and this doesn't take into account the reduced recidivism.
Not taking anything like that. It's just the investment cost. It's just saying, what does it cost to put a person who's had a drug offense through a drug court track versus a business as usual track? Well, I'm not saying that that's a typical figure, that what happened in Multnomah County was unusual. We've seen it a couple of other times happening, and you'll see some of that. But it at least goes to show you that when you don't know your business as usual costs, you really can't price how effective a drug court can be. And part of it, of course, is a Multnomah County is spending a lot of money on business as usual. And sites that don't, you know, sites that, for instance, for a drug offender, just release them, or they don't, you know, prosecute them very much, obviously they're going to be cheap. Say. But if you're prosecuting business as usual and you're taking up a lot of resources, for those of you who are judges or have been judges or attorneys, the real cost of business as usual is the number of times that these people are supposed to appear, when they don't appear, the bench warrants issued, and then it has to be set over. That adds up.
You can see in the court time, that's exactly what happened in that court time transaction, and that's one of the strengths of the approach is that we can break it down and find out where are the costs happening, what's the most expensive thing that we're doing.
Right.
The court time is almost exactly the same. Even though in a drug court setting, the offender's coming for the judge regularly, they only use a few minutes every time, and there's 40, 50 people, other participants, all there at once, and they're getting processed through quickly. For the other, on the other side, it's just that one offender comes before the judge, and then, oh, we're not ready, we don't have the police report, and it gets set over, and then they all come together again for another hearing, and like, oh, it got set over, the police report still didn't come through, or we're not ready, or I changed my lawyer, and soon it's pretty much taken up the same amount of time as if they gone to drunk court.
So this surprised us initially, and NIG was very interested in it too, but as I said, we've seen it in other places. Let's keep going. Our net investment in California. This is using, you know, we have done many sites. We're just using these as examples. Here's, I think, a very interesting set of examples that Shannon's put together because it shows you the range of drug courts in California, how different they are. So, for instance, this is, again, just the net investment cost, not talking about outcomes here, not talking about recidivism. In other words, it costs the people in Orange County about $3,600 per participant to put on a drug court. So it's sort of expensive in Orange County. Orange County is an expensive system anyway. You know, and that's part of it is the local cost system you utilize.
Can I actually?
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's actually two. They have five drug courts in Orange County alone. And so we looked at two of them, and you can see Orange County LN is Laguna Niguel, Orange County Santa Ana. Same county. Same. They have a drug court coordinator that coordinates all five drug courts. Same policies. Yet they do things enough differently within the same county that the costs came out that different. And part of that is the population. The reason drug courts are different is that they have different populations. In the Laguna Niguel, it's mostly high-tech, high-end people. That was the most expensive drug court we've run into, and that was the first drug court I've ever been to where I was mistaken for a participant. I came in with my SID and my laptop, and the bailiff said, you know, I started to walk through to meet with the judge where I was supposed to be going, and the bailiff said, no, you need to sit with the other participants. And I look over, and all the participants are in their suits with their laptops, and they're working on their stuff. And that's the only drug court I've ever been in where the judge apologized to the participants that were waiting, that they had to wait so long. I'm sorry, we'll get to you soon. You know, I have to deal with these other cases first. It was a very different experience. While in Santa Ana, completely different population, much more low-income homeless people there.
Now, you know, we're just showing some of these as examples. I think probably $1,200 figure, $1,100 figure is more typical, the ones that we found per participant. But you see that El Monte, it only costs $194 more per participant to put somebody through drug court than the other direction. And in San Joaquin, you find the same result as we had in Multnomah County, which is that it actually costs less for the taxpayers in San Joaquin to have a drug court on than it would be for business as usual. So investment costs, oh, this is the slide that you had. Investment costs for businesses are not always much more than traditional cost processing. Shannon, I guess, has put all, how many of these together? Where is it?
I can't remember. I think it's Multnomah County. It's all the drug courts we had at the time that I made this slide. Okay. There's probably 15 drug courts.
Okay. But what you can see by the bar there is the drug courts cost a little bit more than business as usual, but not by very much. Okay. The other thing that with the investment cost of Earth that is valuable here is that you can actually do a breakdown about what it costs a particular agency, how much the Superior Court spend or not spend for participant, what's their net investment, about the district attorney's office, the public defender, treatment, law enforcement. This is in California here, and an average, and you see that in some cases they actually saved money over business as usual. The district attorney office, for instance, saved $235 per participant by doing it. Almost all of them do. Treatment costs more. You see that? The treatment agencies, there's more money spent on treatment in drug court than there was in business as usual. Actually, that's good news. You know, I mean, that's a cost, but it means that they're getting into treatment and spending the money appropriately. Okay. And then outcome costs. That's the part that everybody's, that's the bottom line, I guess, in some ways. So do you avoid costs down the road by putting people through drug court as opposed to business as usual? And the net outcome benefit, again, is the same thing as the net investment cost. If you take the outcome costs for drug court participants, all of them, not just the graduates, and compare them to your business as usual match comparison group, and you look 3-4 years down the road, and do you see one costing more and one costing less? That's the net investment cost, okay? And again, here's the net outcome benefit.
Do you have a question? Are the investment, the initial investment costs wrapped into that?
No.
Or is
no,
it completely separate?
Right. We're separating them here for the purposes of your seeing how much does it cost to put on drug court, how much does drug court avoid down the road, and then we'll put them together. That's the last slide. Okay. This is the net outcome benefits. This is what did they save the taxpayer. Remember, this is taxpayer-only money. We don't look at anything else besides what we taxpayer money. And here, again, is an interesting thing about our approach, because you see that it doesn't, there's a range here. And again, you should expect that. Why would all drug courts have exactly the same outcomes? They wouldn't necessarily. But what's interesting here is it ranges from about $3,300 over 4 years per participant in orange to about $16,000 in Stanislaus per participant over that 4-year period. The most interesting one is the one that's still labeled Central Coast, because we had to get their permission to put on the slide, and the slide hasn't changed since then, and we do now. It's Monterey, California. In Monterey, California, we found a minus $9,281. What does that mean? It means the drug court was worse than the business as usual. The drug court, you know, cost the taxpayer, did not avoid costs. I mean, and again, for those of you who are drug court advocates, you say, oh, don't show that, don't show that. But look, wouldn't you expect some drug courts not to work? You know, because of the way they're implemented, because of the way they're structured, because maybe the population, for a variety of reasons. And what our technique does is it suggests that. And you want to talk about some of the reasons why?
Just really quickly, I'll say, in particular in Monterey, that it tells you how important the key components are. And if you're not following the key components, then your outcomes aren't necessarily going to be what you would expect for a drug court. One of the main things they did was that they rotated their judges regularly and gave them no training. So within a year or less than a year, each rotation, the judge would come in, have no training, and just say, you're doing drug court now. They didn't have to like drug court. They didn't have to support drug court. They just had to do it. So not surprisingly, that didn't go over very well. They didn't, you know, their program is 18 months long. So that means that their participants had at least two judges, if not three judges, before they got done. One of the key components is having a relationship with the judge, having a regular relationship. You can't have a relationship with someone who's rotating through and doesn't even know who you are.
Did they look at this and change?
Yes.
Yes.
That was the interesting thing. The drug court coordinator, I believe, was that right? No, whoever.
The judge. There's a new judge came on who was a big drug court supporter and said, we can't keep doing it this way. And he's the one who gave us permission to use their name because he thought it was really important information to be able to put out there that you can't just rotate judges through. One of the other things that they did is right during the time frame that we were studying, they decided to have participants pay for their own drug tests. That's fine. Some drug courts do that. But the problem is they didn't do it for new participants coming on. They just said, starting right now, today, you have to start paying for your drug tests, and they charged them $15 a drug test, and they had at least three a week. That's kind of expensive for people who aren't making, you know, for that population, having to spend $45 a week on drug tests meant they said, you know, it's not worth it, and dropped right out of the program. So they had a very low graduation rate. They made policy decisions without thinking about its impact on the participants. So it makes sense that they wouldn't do well.
I always envision it's possible that that some of the drug court participants went out and stole money in order to pay for their fees, you know.
Or maybe got some drugs to sell.
I know we're running out of time. Can I get on to stuff? Almost out. Okay.
Yeah.
We can do net outcome cost by agency. Well, this is the Portland one, but I'll run through it real quickly. Who saved the most money? That's really what that, in terms of outcomes. Well, the big saver was law enforcement. If you're going to have recidivism down the road and it's going to save rearrests and reincarceration, it's law enforcement that saves the big bucks. And that's, by the way, one of the issues in cost analysis is that the people putting on the drug court, are not the big savers down the road. It's the correctional system, law enforcement are the big savers, and not necessarily the court system. I mean, that's just true. And the same thing with the California studies. We've had the same sort of issue. Law enforcement again has the big bucks. Correction has the big bucks. There is savings in other per person in other areas, but and treatment of course is more. But the big bucks were law enforcement and correction.
What that treatment means is, I mean, these are treatment outcomes. This is after drug court treatment. So people who go to drug court tend to re-engage in treatment again more often than people who never went through drug court and never got treatment to begin with.
Yeah.
Which could, you know, how do you interpret that? Yeah, it's more of a cost, but on the other hand, that's a good thing that they understand when they need treatment are going in and getting it.
They're still engaging in treatment. That's what that figure is saying, even after they've left the drug court. Okay. And this is in Baltimore, Maryland. Again, you see the chart. I'm trying to... Okay, net outcome benefits juvenile drug courts, again, same sort of thing. The net outcome benefits $1,000 per participant, the savings over a 2-year period. Let's go on.
Graduates.
Graduates have the highest, outcome benefit. Of course they do. Because they generally don't reoffend very much. But that really isn't, we don't think that's a fair test of the two approaches. And, okay, this is the overall net benefits per year, subtracting investment costs from outcome costs. This is the final figure that we would come up with in a report. In Portland, they were saving about $1.2 million. In Baltimore, about $800,000. El Monte was only $151,000. Monterey, they lost money, and so what the technique does is it allows you to come up finally with what is a bottom line figure for that particular local jurisdiction. And we believe you can't, it's hard to do cost analysis without making it local, especially public funds.
And this is per year.
And this is per year.
For 1 year, this is the savings.
Right. And so what it suggests is that some courts do very well in their systems. Some courts do, most courts save the taxpayer money. That's probably the bottom line of this. Most courts save the taxpayer money. Some do better than others. Some, there are a few that don't work. But the other part of our technique, because we can break it down, we know so much of the process of what's going on, what protocols are being used, is we're now being able to put this together and say, here are the practices that are most associated with the more successful courts. Here are the practices that lead to less positive investment costs and even negative costs.
You want to add, I mean, he said some courts don't work, but honestly, in the 45 or so that I've studied, this is the only one. The one in Monterey is the only one that we
that
found so far.
It's probably the most interesting. Is
exactly.
There anything else you pulled out of that? I mean, obviously, changing the judges, and we actually knew that to start with. I mean, all the judges said, you know, the real key is to have a committed judge who's going to follow through. Judge Graves is a great example. But
the other,
aside from the judge and the paid drug test, were there any other factors that you pulled out of there?
Yes, the team wasn't engaged. So the public defender and the prosecuting attorney didn't attend drug court sessions. They didn't come to team meetings except when they felt like it. It was basically the coordinator running the whole thing by herself with the judge that, you know, rotated through and didn't really care about the program. So it was basically the whole thing wasn't really operating as a drug court very well. In my experience observing the court, the judge that was there at the time, not the current judge, was also how she interacted with the participants was very demeaning. I mean, she would, if somebody didn't show up for treatment and then they were brought before the judge, you didn't show up for treatment, she'd say, "You know what a phone is? You could pick up a phone and call when you're not," you know, it was very, she was very non-sympathetic to their situation anyway. So that would probably make me not want to come to court.
I think one of the things that I really like about our approach is that I think we have an ability, you know, to begin to look at best practices, begin to look at protocols and procedures that, and have a bottom line figure. How, you know, are they more cost effective? It's a different perspective in saying, in the terms of taxpayer money, which protocols and procedures produce the most benefits and therefore have the most cost savings.
You want to tell them the final, we just finished another analysis of the Portland court that covered 11 years worth of data, and we pulled out a 10-year period and we looked at their cost savings and found $79 million saved for the Portland Drug Court over a 10-year time period. That's people who entered the program over 10 years and then 5 years out from their entry. So, you know, if we went 10 years out from their entry, the savings keep accumulating as long as they don't get rearrested. Keeps on having issues, then the savings keep accumulating over time. So it's doing well.
Representative Barker?
I just would like to say one thing that you haven't mentioned as far as cost saving is when people are not committing crimes, the lack of victims, which is huge. I mean, one person that's doing the math and needs to get the identity theft and we used to have, where people used to just have open mailboxes sitting down the street, and everybody's.
We actually do use victimization costs. I haven't mentioned it, but that we decided that was actually a taxpayer cost too, because it was a cost to taxpayer.
Yeah.
There are certain costs that we don't do because they're not directly taxpayer costs. But do
I guess it's not in our slides, but we do often in our outcomes. We'll do it both ways because victimization costs are so huge that it skews the results. Enormously, you know, and then it's all due to victimization, and we want to show it's not just victimizations, it's all these other things too.
Representative Krieger has a question.
Yes.
We're talking about victims. What about the person who has recovered that 50% and is working and paying taxes? Have you looked at that?
you know, that's one that we would like to do more. We have harder times getting to revenue data, and that's where it's usually the source. It's usually some sort of employment division. They've been more. We have to look at all kinds of things to get data. I mean, particularly in this day and age, with HIPAA and with a variety of other things that we have to. It's much of our time spent doing things like that. And employment divisions have been more reticent about letting that information out to us. I think that is that's one I would really like to add to this. I mean, there are a few things that we can't get to very well and therefore aren't in here that we'd like to get to very well.
But one of them is social services, too. Are they using food stamps? Are they on their own welfare? Are they using Medicaid or the whatever version that each state uses? And we've been able to get bits and pieces of that data, but it's just not collected very well. A lot of the time, you know, you go to the administrative data set and you find, you know, maybe 20% of your people you can actually find in the database because they didn't enter the data. So we've gotten some of that, but we're still struggling, hoping that the people will start collecting that better.
Well, we should conclude here. This promising practice slide
is
on there.
Hold on, we got another question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly recognize the importance of those more attenuated kinds of cost analysis, like victimization costs and recidivism costs, but it obviously gets more speculative the further away you get from the core costs. And so coming back to the net investment cost, I was surprised by your surprise that the actual investment cost in the Portland, Oregon analysis showed a net savings. And the particular element of it that caught my eye was that the jail time, while it was cheaper to have people in drug court, it wasn't as dramatically cheaper as I would have thought. I mean, it was these figures showed a savings of $1,100 in jail time, and I thought the main function of drug court was to keep people out of jail. Why are they still spending significant time in jail even if they're in the drug court program?
Well, you know, some judges do jail as a sanction. So they will put the person for noncompliance or something. They'll say, well, you know, off for a couple of days in jail. And so jail is used by some judges as a sanction. Now, that counts against the investment cost. You know, the judge has to understand that. In our analysis, that's taxpayer resources being used. And so that's where you get those kind of figures. But
I'm sorry, there's also the terminated people in that group. So if you start drug court and then you fail and you get terminated, then you automatically get the sentence that you would have had before.
Right.
So then you end up, that's also those terminated people in there who had to go in and serve their time in jail and go on probation.
Well, and also in Multnomah County, remember, we've got a jail shortage, as many counties do, and so a lot of the lower level drug people tend to get matrixed out before their
full sentence. Yeah. And also remember, it's per participant, so it's $1,100 per participant, and the Multnomah County Drug Court has around 350, 400 participants that enter every year. So if you multiply 1,100 by 400, you get quite a big jail savings.
Well, if I could just follow up on that point, Madam Chair, what that would suggest is that per participant, on average, is reducing jail time by a third or a little more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just surprised that it's not a more dramatic savings on that component that would then suggest that the net investment was, I would have thought, would be that much.
But again, let me suggest our approach and why I think I like our approach, which is that what we're trying to do to the policy for the policymaker is to say, if you put people through drug court, this is what's going to cost the taxpayer. If you put people through businesses, this is what's going to cost the taxpayer. Now that means we, as Shannon says, we count against the drug court the person that was terminated and goes back and serves their time. Our judges don't want us to do that, you know. But we think that's legitimate because what you're saying when you fund drug courts is we're going to see if putting that particular offender through this track saves the taxpayer money or not. And so the guy that left, you know, the male female that left and served there, that counts against the whole system. See what I'm saying? And so that's why you don't see that. If you just looked at graduates, you'd see a big difference, right? Mm-hmm. But because we are really trying to give you a fair assessment of what the drug court costs to the taxpayer, it's there. It's real. You know, I think our data is much more real than some data because it's very localized and it's very clear. But it's a little more modest than you probably have seen in some other studies.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
That also actually speaks to one of the earlier questions about how long do you keep people in the program. If you terminate them, then you're costing the system money because they're going to go back into the business-as-usual system, which isn't cheap. So that, you know, maybe that's another thing to consider before you terminate somebody from the drug court program.
Thank you very much. Yes. I think we should conclude.
We're done, but you can have we're available for questions. Or
okay. Are there any other questions on any part of the program? Thank you very much. It's been very useful.
Thank you.
Our next item is the OHSU Methamphetamine Center, and we have Aaron Janowski, PhD, here. Except for 10:30, maybe we should just take a 10-minute break here. And anybody who hasn't gotten their flu shots can get their flu shots. And I would like to officially convene the Senate Judiciary Committee, since we now have a quorum. And we will move on to our next program. Our panel has grown here. I appreciate that. If you would all introduce yourselves for the record, and we will hear your presentation on the Methamphetamine Abuse Research Center. Thank you. Maybe Dr. Janowski, you'd like to start.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the center. I'm Aaron Janowski. I'm a professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at Oregon Health Sciences.
Get the mic a little bit closer to you there.
Okay. There you go. I'm a professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm a career scientist at the VA Medical Center in Portland. To my right is Dr. Cameron.
And Bill Cameron, Department of Behavioral Neuroscience, and I head the Science Education Opportunities Office at Oregon Health Science University.
I'm Paul Berger. I'm a VA psychiatrist and an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at Oregon Health Sciences University.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, thank you for the opportunity to discuss our Methamphetamine Abuse Research Center. The notes that you have before you are a little more detailed than the slides that I'm going to show. If you have any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them, as would my colleagues. The Methamphetamine Abuse Research Center was recently funded by the National Institute of Drug Abuse in Washington, D.C., an institute of the National Institutes of Health. In addition, we receive some support from Oregon Health and Science University and from the Portland VA Medical Center. And our hope is to develop new treatments and to investigate the underlying causes of methamphetamine addiction and to develop treatments that may be useful for blocking specific aspects or specific symptoms of methamphetamine abuse. This is a schematic of the molecule from which methamphetamine is derived. Inside the box, you can see amphetamine. Methamphetamine has an additional methyl group coming off of the amphetamine. And on the other end of the molecule, with the two oxygens, the two O's in the structure, that entire molecule makes MDMA, or ecstasy. So that you can see that these drugs are all related, and although they do have different effects in brain, and they get into brain and affect different systems in brain, and they have different clinical symptoms.
Could I ask you just right here, is there any difference between amphetamine and methamphetamine?
There are. They are metabolized differently. They have different lengths of stay in the body, so what we call half-lives in the body. And the effects can also be very different. Dr. Berger, you want to say something to that?
Amphetamines are used as treatment drugs for attention deficit disorder, where methamphetamine is taken orally, whereas methamphetamine is often taken intravenously and has a whole different the addictive properties of intravenous, because it gets to the brain and induces so much euphoria, and then there's such craving after the euphoria wears off that instant up and down like the stock market is enough to really addict people much more than just oral amphetamine.
So it's the method of delivery as much as the chemical
properties? Yeah, we think so. Yeah, and some of these things we don't know, but yeah, that's what we think.
Okay, because a lot of us have wondered that, you know, here you have this devastating drug and a similar drug that is used routinely. You know, how do you square that physiologically?
Yeah, and some of the things we don't know. That's why we do research. It's a good question.
Thank you.
Cocaine has been another problem throughout the world, actually, and this slide summarizes the differences between the effects of methamphetamine and cocaine. The sites of action are actually relatively similar. So there are proteins in the brain called transporters that inactivate neurotransmitters, and cocaine binds to the transporters and prevents the metabolism of the neurotransmitters. Methamphetamine, on the other hand, goes through the transporter, displacing the neurotransmitter, and so that there is more available. In addition, it gets into the cell, gets and interacts with other transporters inside the cell to again displace neurotransmitters and flood the areas of the brain that through which transporters exert their effects, synapses in the brain, so that there is a great deal more of the neurotransmitter available. The duration of action for methamphetamine is a lot longer, hours, if not a day. Cocaine is very short half-life, about 20 minutes. Methamphetamine has been shown to kill nerve cells in the brain. And in fact, one exposure to methamphetamine has permanent and or long-lasting effects. Cocaine has not been shown to be neurotoxic. That is, it doesn't kill the nerve cells. The pattern for using methamphetamine and cocaine are different. With methamphetamine, there's chronic use. With cocaine, there's a lot of binge use. Cardiovascular effects of methamphetamine, as you might expect, are longer, and for cocaine are relatively short. And the studies that have been done on methamphetamine and cocaine differ. There have been quite a few studies done on cocaine, the development of new treatments for blocking the effects of cocaine. But for methamphetamine, there are actually relatively few. I think right now there are about 8 drugs that have been looked at, as opposed to 20 to 30 drugs that have been looked at for cocaine. This is something that we've all seen, and the before and after picture of relatively short use of methamphetamine. I put this up here to remind myself to tell you that our center is not an intervention or treatment center. It's a research center. And because of that, the number of patients that we will be seeing will be relatively small, and it is our hope to expand our ability to see patients and to develop treatments that are standard and approved treatments for methamphetamine abuse. Right now, there are no FDA-approved treatments for methamphetamine abuse.
Madam Chair.
Could you elaborate on that? I mean, I understand. I heard the statement, but it kind of, I think, catches many of us off guard that there's no certified treatment program.
That's correct. There are a number of psychotherapy programs and intervention programs, but there are no pharmacological treatments for approved pharmacological treatments for methamphetamine abuse. In addition, the rate of relapse is extremely high for all of the programs that are used, and it's our hope to develop agents that will reduce the relapse rate.
And just to give us a sense, what would be an example of a pharmacological treatment for cocaine, for example?
The same holds there. There have been a number of studies looking at antidepressants to treat cocaine abuse. Drugs that are used to treat alcohol abuse have been tried for cocaine abuse. And again, to my knowledge, none have been approved by the FDA for
cocaine
abuse.
Because you said that there were many treatments.
There have been a lot of drugs looked at, a lot of drugs that have been examined. Sorry if I wasn't clear there. A lot of drugs have been examined in clinical trials, and none of them have proven to be useful, and or they've had significant deleterious side effects.
So basically you're talking about psychotherapy and just keeping people off the drug long enough to get...
That's correct. This slide shows the categories, I could call them, that people fall into. So of all the people that use methamphetamine, approximately 24% of them are less than 18 years old. So 25%, a quarter of the population that uses methamphetamine are teenagers. The largest group is the age group just after that, just a little older than that, the 18 to 23-year-old group. But even in 40-year-old, an older group, there are a number of people who get into trouble using methamphetamine. So it's pervasive throughout the population. The next few slides I'll go through rather quickly. You may have seen them before, but they show the incidence of methamphetamine admissions per 100,000 people across the country. And the importance of this slide is that a couple of things. One is that the incidence of use and getting into trouble with methamphetamine is spreading rapidly from west to east, so that now Washington and the National Institutes of Health are becoming interested because it's starting to affect the big cities on the East Coast. The other important part of the slide is that Oregon is shown here as a red state. You don't see that very often. Okay. So you can see that the march of methamphetamine across the country, that was 1993. This is 1995. 11 states have serious problems, going to 14 states. And there's still 14 states, but there are other states in which the condition is worsening. And actually, in the Midwest right now, their use and problems with methamphetamine are about the same as what we have here. And in fact, if you talk to colleagues, when we talk to colleagues across the country, what they say is, oh, my state is definitely the capital of methamphetamine abuse. And would that were true, but we know from statistics that it's still here in Oregon. So methamphetamine has a very high cost to society. About 4.7 million Americans have tried methamphetamine at some time. Use by pregnant women is a real problem. We know that there are great problems with children of women who have used methamphetamine during pregnancy. This is a much bigger problem than was seen with cocaine. You probably remember hearing about crack babies. That problem sort of dissipated, and what we have now is measurable problems with children from women who use methamphetamine during pregnancy. This statistic at the bottom of this slide showing that 85% of property crimes related to methamphetamine use, that's actually a very conservative figure that was given to me by the assistant, one of the assistant police chiefs in Portland, and I think the figure he used was 95%, but it varies across the literature depending on what outcome you're looking at. So we need to address this problem, and that was one of the things that we wanted to do with our methamphetamine center. This slide contains some statistics on that I've done some recalculations on. What I wanted to show you was in Oregon, there were 584 busts of laboratories, home labs, in 2002. And so I went to the census tables and looked up the population of Oregon, and that breaks down to about 16 labs per 100,000 people, which is essentially a little bit more than one lab per neighborhood. Now, I live on Mount Tabor in Portland, which is a very nice neighborhood, and one of the nicer neighborhoods in that nice neighborhood burned down a few years ago because there was a meth lab in it. So this is a really pervasive problem and affects all neighborhoods across the state. As I said, there are no approved drug treatments for methamphetamine abuse. Inpatient hospitalization is what's used for treating severe cases of long-term meth dependence, and it is very expensive. The optimum treatment for meth involves intensive outpatient setting with 3 to 5 visits per week. So as you can see, the current way to treat methamphetamine abuse and addiction is extremely expensive, and what we would like to do is to turn that around and to find treatments that are far less expensive and may not involve the penal system.
And you were focusing on people who were not in the penal system, is that correct? But you didn't look at the drug court model, for example.
Yeah, that's correct, we have not. Globally, meth use is second only to use of marijuana and is used more than cocaine and heroin combined. In 2003, there were about 215 admissions to hospitals per 100,000 population in Oregon. And one unique aspect of Oregon meth users is that many have been using the drug for a very long time, greater than 10 years. In addition, methamphetamine use in Oregon by individuals appear to prefer methamphetamine to cocaine, so that we are able to work with patients who only use methamphetamine, and that work isn't contaminated by their use of cocaine. So obviously we need to improve drug abuse education and to prevent the first use of methamphetamine, and we need to develop new treatments based on rational drug design, and those are the focuses, the foci of our center. The center includes 20 investigators from multiple departments, mostly from the Department of Psychiatry and the Department of Behavioral Neuroscience at Oregon Health and Science University. About half of the people are at the VA, the other half are at OHSU. And the themes that we chose to look at are themes that we could use when we did both animal studies and human studies. So we're interested in the neuroanatomy of methamphetamine. That is to say, what areas of the brain are affected by methamphetamine? And more importantly, are there areas of the brain that may be different in methamphetamine abusers and that predispose them to get into trouble with methamphetamine? In addition, we're interested in neuroadaptation. That is to say, what effects on the brain does methamphetamine have? How does it change the expression of genes in the brain? And are there genes in the brain that also might predispose people to use methamphetamine? We know from the work that is being done in the Department of Behavioral Neuroscience that, in fact, that is true for the use of alcohol. The Department of Behavioral Neuroscience has a long history of looking at the genetics of drug abuse and is actually the first department in the country to isolate a gene that appears to predispose humans and animals to alcohol abuse. We're also interested in impulsivity. Impulsivity is a very important aspect of human behavior. If you can reduce impulsivity, you can reduce crime. Methamphetamine patients appear to be highly impulsive, and we can measure that in both humans and animals. In addition, we're interested in stress. The reason we're interested in stress is because stress is known to be one of the major causes of recidivism in treatment programs for drugs of abuse. So if we can reduce stress-induced relapse and impulsivity, we can address a lot of the problems related to methamphetamine abuse. One unique aspect of our center is its collaborative and translational nature. This is the first center that has been funded by the National Institutes of Health and the National Institute of Drug Abuse in particular, that contains both clinical and basic research components. We thought this was very important because we can address in animals things that we can't do in humans, and we can inform the clinicians of our findings. And in return, the clinicians can tell us what they have found, and we can further refine their findings using animal studies. So the translational nature of the center is bidirectional, going from clinical to basic research and from basic research to clinical research. We also have an education component that is probably definitely one of the more important components of the center and is probably the preeminent education component in a center of this sort in the country. When our grant was reviewed, the scientists who reviewed it were jealous of what we could do. The Methamphetamine Center is organized into cores, so there's an administrative core that deals with budgets and the flow of paperwork. The biostatistics core uses state-of-the-art computing techniques to analyze data at both from both clinical studies and basic research studies, and to compare data across animal studies and human studies. We have an animal supply core because we use animals that are inbred and are bred for certain behaviors related to methamphetamine behavior and methamphetamine's effects. And then we have an education and outreach core. In the scientific components, we're interested in the neurochemistry involved in methamphetamine seeking, and so we have animals that are trained to self-administer methamphetamine. They seem to enjoy it, and we can use those animals to look at stress-induced relapse and impulsivity. We can look at genes involved in their behavior. We're also interested in reward and sensitization, and so again, we're looking at the genes that are involved and how they change when methamphetamine is taken. And as I mentioned, we know that even after one dose of methamphetamine, there are permanent changes in brain. And then finally, that data will be fed to the clinical side of things, where Dr. Berger will be looking at new treatments for methamphetamine abuse for specific symptoms related to methamphetamine induced, including stress-induced relapse and impulsivity. And finally, we have the opportunity with this funding from the National Institutes of Health to look at very innovative aspects of treatment and the etiology of drug abuse. So we can look at impulsivity using the state-of-the-art imaging, the scanners that we have at OHSU, and I'll show you some data on that in a minute. We can also look at self-administration and impulsivity that other centers in the country have not been able to look at, and that plays a large role in the effects of methamphetamine. And then finally, we can look at what neurotransmitter systems are involved in the effects of methamphetamine, and we have some very interesting data suggesting that histamine is in fact involved in the prenatal effects of methamphetamine. I hesitate to say things like that last statement because people who see the role of histamine in the long-term effects will think that, I should say the kind of people who are addicted or abusing methamphetamine will look at that and say, well, I can just take an antihistamine and I'll be fine. And it's really a lot more complicated than that.
Just diverting for half a second now that you've mentioned this neonatal situation. When you talked, I remember when the crack baby issue, and you passed it off, oh, nothing happened. Something happened.
Something happened.
We studied it, or did we ignore it?
No, that has been studied exhaustively.
Can some of that be useful in this study of meth?
That's an excellent question, and some of that will be useful. However, in my second or third slide, I showed you there were differences between methamphetamine and cocaine, and the problem that we have in this field, especially regarding methamphetamine, is that we have to go back and redo all of the data, relook at all of the data for cocaine, and readjust all of the instruments and tests that we do, because they were developed for cocaine. They weren't developed for methamphetamine. And so we've had to take a step backward. So when someone who gets into trouble with cocaine is asked, when was the last time you used cocaine, we have a pretty good idea of whether they're giving us an honest answer or not. For methamphetamine, we don't know. That has not been quantified, and so we need to go back and look at that. And we know from both animal and human studies that the methamphetamine problem with prenatal exposure to methamphetamine is far greater than it was for cocaine. That we know.
Thank you for that happy news.
So this is not a before and after picture. These are two investigators in our center, Dr. Suzanne Mitchell in the Department of Behavioral Neuroscience and Psychiatry, has brought the ability to test impulsivity to quantify the results to Oregon Health and Science University, and her work is pervasive throughout our Methamphetamine Abuse Research Center. And Dr. William Hoffman, psychiatrist, at the VA Medical Center and in the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU, have been looking at impulsivity and what's going on in the brains of methamphetamine patients when they are trying to make decisions. So the test that they give is to ask the patients or the control subject, would you rather have $22 now or $100 in 66 days? And then they vary the amount of money. Would you rather have $50 now or $100 in 66 days? And they vary the amount of time. So it's $10 now or $100 in 20 days. And from that, you can derive from indifference points. That is the point at which the patient or the control subject starts to say, I'd rather take the money later. You can do a calculation, putting all the data together, and what we found is that methamphetamine addicts almost always take the money now. And you can hear them muttering under their breath, well, you know, I could use a pack of cigarettes. I'll take the money now. And so what we found is that methamphetamine abusers discount more heavily than controls. In other words, they're willing to settle for less. And that essentially describes a lot of their lives. They're willing to settle for less. And so our interest now is to find out what areas of the brain are involved in that and how might we change that. And Dr. Hoffman has done some functional magnetic resonance imaging studies involving a number of patients and controls. And as you can see in the orange areas that are lit up in the upper left panel, that's a control subject. And you can see that there are a number of areas that are lit up. Those are areas that are activated while the control subject is taking the test inside the scanner. Those are areas that are lit up when someone is making a decision about getting the money now or waiting and getting more money later. And as you can see in the meth subject, there's quite a difference. There is very, very little, there are a few areas that are lit up as in the control subject. So it's as if their brains are not activated.
You know, there's a real issue here, and I think ethically it would be hard to test this, but how can you tell what's cause and what's effect, whether the brain started out that way or whether it was the meth that induced that?
That's an outstanding question. I wish I could answer that with some degree of certainty. We're trying to design experiments to answer that question because it's very possible that this is not an effective meth. It's also possible that it is an effective meth.
I'll volunteer representative. Before and after for you.
Paul, did you want to add anything to that? No, okay, that's something that we're wrestling with. Because, again, the patients that we see have already taken a substantial amount of methamphetamine, and we know that the systems in their brains are changed after one dose, right? So that's a problem.
Can the animals be helpful on this?
Yes, yeah, very much so. And we can do animal studies because at OHSU we have what is right now the preeminent facility for doing imaging studies in the country, if not the world. That will change in a few months when somebody else gets the next generation of scanners. But right now we have the best ones in the country, and there are animal studies planned for asking questions exactly like that.
Or is there any possibility of some kind of longitudinal study like the Framingham study?
Yes.
Study big populations, and then some of them are going to end up using meth?
Yes, and we're interested in in dealing with teenagers who have maybe not yet been exposed, and to studying them for long periods of time and seeing if we can't predict who might get into trouble with methamphetamine. Now, we are doing genetic studies, and so we're looking for genes in animals that will tell us what gene, and we're also going to be looking in humans, and we're hoping that those genes will tell us who's going to get into trouble with methamphetamine. This is a picture of Dr. Mark, who's interested in the neurochemistry of methamphetamine's effects. Dr. Mark is a member of the Department of Behavioral Neurosciences at OHSU, and he does studies in animals and gives his data to Dr. Berger, who will be doing the clinical studies. And what Dr. Mark has found is something that was very interesting. As you can see at the top of the screen, I have a statement that all addictive drugs increase the release of the neurochemical dopamine. Now, they do it by different mechanisms. So cocaine, which blocks the reuptake of dopamine by blocking this transporter, means the dopamine will be staying around longer and will not be metabolized. Methamphetamine does the same thing. So all drugs of abuse do that, but they do it by different mechanisms. And so there's been a lot of work done on dopamine systems. But what Dr. Mark has found is that acetylcholine, another neurotransmitter, is also affected by methamphetamine. Finally, one of the more important things that our center does is education and outreach. These are not two methamphetamine addicts. In fact, the gentleman with the red ribbon is the chairman of the Department of Behavioral Neuroscience at OHSU, and he's speaking to a student concerning brain neuroanatomy, and he's involved in Kids Judge, which is one of the events that we will be sponsoring, helping to sponsor in the state, and that is run by Dr. Cameron. So the Education Corps will be coordinating activities among all of the NIDA centers. We'll be training new investigators, both clinicians and basic researchers in drug abuse, especially related to methamphetamine. We'll be involved in a lot of educational forums, especially rural outreach programs, which we're already involved in. And we hope to enhance the role of OHSU as a national research and clinical center. In the future, we hope to increase the clinical and educational endeavors. Although we were funded by the National Institutes of Health, our budget was cut due to the current financial situation in Washington. And so we had to make some cuts, and we're hoping to improve both of those components of the center. This is a list of the 20 investigators that are involved. As you can see, about half are at OHSU and half are at the VA. And I want to thank you again for the opportunity to describe our center.
Thank you very much. It's quite a resource to have you, since Oregon has such a big problem. It's a very appropriate place from all kinds of standpoints. Questions, Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question and immediate follow-up. I'm assuming earlier we get to the people using meth, the more success.
That's an excellent question. Clearly, people who are only taking a pill every now and then are going to respond differently to treatment than people who are intravenously self-administering methamphetamine.
So my follow-up, I would like to see or ask why are you going to include dentists in your team? And then, because I've also talked to dentists who tell me they can look in a young person's mouth and see if that person is getting to use meth. But do we need to look at legislation to allow a dentist to tell the parents that you need to check your kid out?
That part I'll let you work out. But, you know, it's interesting. The VA, we're sort of a you know, we have this computer system where the patient is in a giant system. So all my patients see the dentist. All my about half of my patients, I had no idea that psychiatry was a liver specialty. Half of my patients have hepatitis C, and I've gotten very friendly with the liver doctors. And so I can turn on the computer and watch my patients in real time as they go into their, you know, their various appointments and coordinate with the dentist and with the liver doctors. And where that's important is getting at your question and your earlier question about the drug court. We're sort of a complementary approach. I think the broader question you're asking is, these people, if you get to them, how do you get to them early? One of my biggest worries as a clinician is that there's a huge number of patients, we don't even know how huge, who are not treatment seeking at all. So if we come up with the magic bullet, if they don't want it, it's not going to do any good. So one thing the center's trying to do clinically is we're taking people who are being hospitalized, who are coming through the ER, and we're hospitalizing them on the inpatient unit, sort of a complementary approach to drug courts, to try to hook them in through the medical system. Mm-hmm. And in the VA, we see people for years, and that way, when the patients are not treatment-seeking, we can try to figure out ways to whisper into their ears and beg them and cajole them to try to, you know, but I think you do need a strategy to go after the majority of patients who are just out there using tons of meth and are not treatment seeking, and the drug courts are part of that, and we're trying to develop another component, the medical system, because the patients are very sick, so we see them and we can try to plug them into treatment.
We actually had considered offering some dental treatment to get patients to join the studies, but it turns out we probably don't need that incentive.
But when they're hospitalized as part of our center, they get dental consults, they get hospitalized on a unit that is specialized in dual diagnoses, and that's one of our hooks to get the people in, is that they get very good medical care.
Thank you. My point in asking the question, I went to a meth support group discussion one night, and one young gentleman was a heavy user, and his mother worked in the dental office. And in their conversation, he says, "Mom," because she was saying, "I didn't know he was doing it." He says, "Mom, you work in a dental office. You didn't notice that my teeth were going bad." I mean, that was his reaction to his mother. So that's why my question again, we really need to look at maybe having dental offices or dentists help us in identifying this problem, especially for minors.
If I could address it from the educational viewpoint, is that we are working with the School of Dentistry now on Project The Meth Mouth, and training the dentists of the future to understand the early signs that you can see associated with that. But again, it's a little bit more of a professional policy set into place on whether a child that is not covered under HIPAA, that's pre-18, those type of topics are topics for discussion that dentists should take on. And I think that's something that we have brought to the arena of discussion, at least at the level of the dental school, and that's actually a very good outlet for getting to the rest of the dental community.
Would you support legislation to require dentists to report?
Whoa. Okay.
We have to look to our government relations.
Well, personally, you're asking, I mean, I think the idea that I don't think there's any of the dental students or anything that wouldn't see the benefit of making an identification very early on. And it's just a matter of the rapport with the patient and the patient's family. I think policy is important. That's, again...
You stepped into a hornet's nest. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there would be no barriers to the dentist, a properly trained dentist, discussing with the patient, bringing up the issue and having a discussion with the patient. Where you'd run into kind of a sticky wicket is reporting to a third party, whether it be a parent or or some kind of outside party. And we've got that issue in some other forums in this state right now. So. Okay. Are there other questions? Thank you.
Sir, I have one question. The good doctor. Doctor, you mentioned impulsivity, and you also mentioned for the statistics that most of the users are around teenage years, early 20s.
I understand that it's what period of time in the development of the brain that the impulse controls if they come in. I understand it's usually the wiring up front.
I think part of the definition of younger than 18 includes impulsivity for everybody. So I can't answer that question for sure. I'll look into that and try and get an answer for you.
Follow-up question. The people who are more likely to be into meth because of impulsivity, does that mean that the wiring never comes in or what?
That's what we're looking at.
Of course, we also think meth makes people more impulsive. So right. Both sides, it's all the above to your question. You know, some people have the genetic vulnerability because of impulsivity, and others are made more impulsive by the meth.
But that impulsivity may be just even reflected in their driving behavior and other things that would indicate the number of risks that they're willing to take. That could be something measurable to be a predictor of them being at risk for other impulsive pitfalls.
And there's sort of a discrepancy. The bench stuff really suggests ways of reversing this. So, I mean, and it just hasn't made it to clinical trials yet, and that's sort of what our center is about. You try to come up with some kind of magic bullet, you know, that you would treat, you know, so you were asking what a drug would do. So my patients, you know, we'll treat them at the Substance Abuse Treatment Program in Portland, VA. Some of them will get off of meth. Then they'll, a girlfriend will come back in town, or they'll get, the most common ones, they get a windfall of money. The VA service connection comes through. And then they suddenly have all this money, and that triggers incredible craving. It's like a reflex. It's like you smelling food, you get hungry. So that's one thing. Another one is, you know, the wife divorces the patient. The patient gets stressed. And then the further thing is the patient then smokes some meth. And after a day or two, they're back to where they were. All those things are long-term changes in the brain that the bench science kind of understands. And so the potential is there for a magic bullet to reverse all that. So that, you know, you take my patient who, thanks to the very dedicated treatment providers, are really off of meth. And then you would treat them just for about a few months. And the hope would be to reverse some of the long-term damage of meth so that when they're exposed to environmental triggers, they don't have as strong a response to them. They don't, you know, that you're never going to cause total amnesia, but the idea is they'd be exposed to cues and it doesn't elicit as much craving. Then if they do slip, they don't turn right back into a meth abuser as quickly as they do now because their brain's been rewired. It could be rewired back a little bit. That's the hope from the magic bullet, to reverse, to de-addict the people. And we think another thing, we think our patients are not motivated. Not all of them. A lot of my patients complain that they feel, even after a year of being absent, that their motivation hasn't come back. And the bench scientists feel that that's caused by the chronic meth, that meth usurps motivation. That's such a powerful reward that all the other rewards lose their incentive, motivational properties. And we're hoping we can reverse that.
And these committees went to, or most of the members of this committee went to Pendleton about a year and a half ago, and we heard some pretty compelling medical testimony about these changes, and they put up slides showing how the actual synapse got broken in meth users. But then they also showed slides that in adult meth users, the synapse over time would tend to get restored, but in adolescents, it would come back skewed. Are you doing any of that kind of research? Because you're showing a huge percentage for under 18 meth users. And these slides that we saw earlier would suggest that damage is more severe than damage to an adult brain.
Right. Well, there's no question that early exposure changes I'll call it the migration pattern of neurons, and is also, as I mentioned, neurotoxic, so that you're killing off nerve cells that should not be killed off at that particular point in time of the developing teenager, let's say. And so my lab actually is doing some work on developmental effects of drugs.
And then I guess another medical question I'd have is, you know, I asked you earlier about amphetamines, which are used in some of the ADD drugs. Do the amphetamines kill off it? Are they neurotoxic too?
That's very controversial.
There's evidence that there are certain cells in brain that are not nerve cells, but they are activated by the amphetamines, and they're not activated by other drugs.
Can I take a step back, though, from that? See, what's different about our center, one of the things that's different is we're people who, we're sort of from, what my patients would say, bottoms up. Dr. Janowski is a real bench scientist. We publish papers. We love to publish. You know, publish or perish. That's kind of, you know, do or die, you know, and
the neurotoxicity.
Yeah. So in the so that's something where there are a lot of publications on your question, and it actually has not been resolved one way or another. There are good people who feel strongly that in the human brain, amphetamines don't damage the brain, and there are other people that feel just as strongly the other way. So, you know, that's the beauty of the peer-reviewed science process, is that it can sort out questions that you can't sort out otherwise.
Well, I think you can see where I'm going with this. These drugs are so pervasive among young people right now. Are we predisposing them to become meth users?
Well, it's a reasonable question. We don't have the answer. That would be my answer.
Yeah. Certainly availability is one big risk factor. And I'm the father of a 13-year-old daughter who is exposed to drugs on a weekly, if not daily, basis. And so I have concerns.
Yeah. And, you know, the flip side, though, as a clinician, you know, that's not my field, but what the people in that field will answer you is that if you treat attention deficit disorder in people who have a severe case and it's appropriate to be treating them, then you're lowering their risk of drug abuse. So, yeah, the stimulant itself may have that property. We don't know much to increase vulnerability, but the underlying disorder, you're treating that, and that clearly in severe drug abusers, I mean severe attention deficit disorder, when you treat with stimulants, the consensus is that you're lowering the risk of drug abuse because you're treating this very severe illness. And then there's another question about overusing stimulants in kids, and that's a totally separate question.
It has been very fascinating.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Chair, there were some slides they used we didn't have. Is there a way to get copies of those?
We're having our presentation on the laptop, and they will be duplicated and passed out to you. We apologize for the discrepancy.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming today. It's a very exciting endeavor you have going on. Mr. Taylor, did you have some comments?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, our next item is, Madam Chair, excuse me, mental health courts. What are they and what are their goals? And I understand that Judge Seelander was supposed to be here. I don't see him here yet. But Judge Graves and Marion County District Attorney Walt Bedrow are here. They are in the process of developing a mental health court and would be able to tell us what the process they're going through to do that and why. Okay. Now, I believe that Judge Graves would also like to make some comments about his drug court and connection with the presentations we've had this morning.
Actually, I almost invited you out after the other presentation to see if you had any comments. So, why don't we go ahead?
One further thing is, Patsy Wood just wanted me to remind you that in your packet there is a letter from Judge Stephen Tipton in Deschutes County concerning his mental health court. I need to mention that so we can put this in the record.
Thank you. Judge Graves and Mr. Bedlow, why don't you come on up?
Good to see you again, co-chairs and members of the committee. I feel right at home here since, in fact, this was our home for a significant period of time. And again, thank you and all the staff people here in the Capitol who made us feel so welcome.
And you still have to give your name for the record, Judge.
I beg your pardon. I'm Dennis Graves. I'm a circuit judge here in Marion County. And
And good morning, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Walt Begla, and I'm the Marion County District Attorney.
I came prepared to follow up on Judge Sealander's comments about his actual experience with the mental health court and explain to you what we're doing here in Marion County in regard to establishing a mental health court and why we haven't done so earlier, and then to give you a brief update on your good work in supplying us with some funds to increase the size of our drug court here in Marion County through the Criminal Justice Commission. And I'd be glad to address those issues in whichever order the chair or the co-chairs prefer. All right. I'll speak first then to the drug court, since we've been dealing with the methamphetamine issue this morning on the agenda. We had a population of 30 in our drug court, and that was limited by how much money we had to buy treatment for those people. When we were aware that you were going to be making some other funds available for drug courts throughout the state, even though we'd all have to compete against one another be awarded those funds through the Criminal Justice Commission application process, we started increasing our numbers because we felt optimistic that we were one of the best drug courts in Oregon, even though there are 25 to 35 other judges across the state who are doing this same kind of work in their local communities and in most of your communities that are represented here on the committee. And so we began increasing our numbers from 30 with a target population of 45, essentially to take the money that you all awarded to the Criminal Justice Commission to be distributed to all of us, some of us in the state, and make more of a difference in our local communities. And I'm here to report to you what we have done in that regard. We have increased from 30 to a current capacity of 42, and in the last month we have had two graduations, and so we are well on our way to achieving that population of 45. I can also tell you that in Marion County have made a decision through cooperation with the district attorney's office to focus on parents of children, and in particular parents of children where the children have been removed and placed in foster care because of their parents' involvement with methamphetamine. And so 90% of the new participants that we've taken into the court since June 30 have children, and those children are all involved with the DHS dependency court. You heard some discussion earlier by Michael Finnegan and Shannon Carey about adult drug courts that are traditionally based on a criminal jurisdiction for the court and family dependency treatment courts. We haven't had a family dependency treatment court in Marion County until very recently, again thanks to some of the funds that you provided, and so we have taken our adult drug court and said we will look for, or rather Mr. Beglau and his office will look for, criminal cases that come through that also had children removed from the home, and that's why we have targeted those participants as parents of young children who've been placed in foster care. Of course, our goal is to help those parents learn to live without methamphetamine, but to get re-engaged with their children through parenting plans, cooperation with the Department of Human Services, Child Protective Service, in working in a coordinated way to hope that those parents and those children can become reunified. And I can tell you that we're being successful in that regard. We've had two reunifications just in the last 3 months. And one of our graduates, who just graduated, also was reunified with her child. She's one of those people who would fit into the question that was asked earlier by Representative Wisnant about if people didn't really want to engage, why not move them out and move someone into their slot? Her case was a simpler case to answer that question because she came before us 6 months pregnant. And she was skinny as a rail, pimples all over her face. You saw the photograph earlier, and high as a kite. And the first time she appeared in front of us before she'd ever opted into drug court, because she was there potentially as a voluntary participant, she was high in court, and so I found her in contempt and we put her in jail. And we found a way, after she'd been in jail and cleaned up for a while, through the other members of our team who were seeing her in the jail, that she elected to become involved with the drug court. And so she moved from that jail cell, after about 3 weeks, into an inpatient treatment bed here in Salem. There are very few of those, but that happened to be available to her. And I can tell you that she delivered that child, and she is parenting that child, and her child that had been removed from her and was in foster care has been returned to her, and she graduated about 3 weeks ago. One of our partners that provides help to us is the faith community. I became aware early on in the experience of running the drug court that there were many things we needed for our participants that we couldn't afford. And there was a community of people in our Marion County that was willing to help. And so we partnered with the faith community. And in this particular case with Corrine, the faith community really sort of snuggled around her. They provided baby clothes for her new baby, and mothers and grandmothers to kind of help her with the parenting, in addition to the parenting classes that she had. They provided some spiritual help for her, which was totally at her own choice. No requirement, simply her own choice. And they focused on her at a recent service, explaining how their church is reaching out to others in the community. And probably 3,000 to 5,000 people saw the CD that was made of her. A very, very compelling story of a person who was forced into the treatment program that she otherwise would have turned her back on. And she's one of those success stories with those two children now. And she's employed full-time. She's been employed. She works as a baker here in Marion County. She works a shift of about 5 to 1 in the morning. She has daycare for the children. She picks them up after she gets off work. She's a happy mom. And she said, to quote her in the CD, "I learned not to just become a mom, not to just become a mother, but to become a mommy to my children." That says it all for her. In regard to the people that are in drug court now, I can tell you that about 30% of them have a serious mental health condition, which takes me to the issue of the planning for our mental health court. Before I get to that, I'm wondering if there are questions about the drug court and anything that Walt might want to add in regard to our drug court.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Grace, could we get a copy of that CD?
I think so. I don't have a copy yet, but I'll see if I can get one.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I just had a few comments, and I wanted just to express my full support of Judge Graves and the Adult Drug Court Program, and of course our juvenile programs as well that are addressing juvenile addiction issues. And I remember the comment earlier about the meth addicts are basically willing to settle for less, but many of them are willing to give up anything. And if there's any phrase that I've used to describe methamphetamine and what we're seeing in our drug courts, is that meth literally corrodes the natural bonds of parenthood. And we're seeing parents just give up their children to get high on meth. So this program, and I saw those themes come out, is built around continuity, that we have a consistent judicial response around commitment, and you can't have a drug court that works without a DA, a defense attorney, and a court on board and willing to give that energy and will to the program. And finally, the accountability piece. And sometimes that just means using your jail to get a pregnant mother held until you can get that individual tied into a residential or an intensive outpatient program. So, you know, it's really, we've heard a lot this morning, it's really a people business. It's about people, and when I look at the different ingredients that go into designing your court and who you have come into it and who you don't, there's a lot of ingredients to that. And sometimes it's the will of the individual. Sometimes it's the resource available. Sometimes there's themes that you have, and our theme is children and family, because we want to have the biggest impact in our community. And one of those ingredients is also your community. So we look at those folks that are living here and that investment in our community when we make those decisions as a team and make our recommendations to the court. So that's an important concept as you make those choices. I heard the word cherry pick, and we don't cherry pick. Sometimes we just take the hardest case right there, right in front of us, because we want to make a difference. And those folks are in our program. So I just wanted to highlight one thing about drug court and alternatives. There are no good alternatives in your public safety system. As you know, and I have touted this pretty strongly before, we're doing a whole lot of nothing around many of the crimes in the state. And it's a lower-end property, and we're reaching into our felonies as well. And one of the things I wanted to tell you that we're doing is partnerships in the community, and we have what's called the Willamette University No Meth Law Clerk position, where all first-time meth offenses, those in possession, are filed, because I have this partnership with Willamette University and our No Meth community to file those cases as misdemeanor, and the very first stop is drug court. If I did not have that partnership and the commitment of my community, I would not file those crimes. And see, this is happening in every county of the state. And so we're doing what we can. I just wanted to highlight that, is that drug court is an effective financial tool and one that reaches family, but it's also absolutely necessary, and we're doing whatever we can to maximize and leverage resources to address addiction. So those are my thoughts around drug court, and I appreciate the opportunity to even speak this morning. I was just coming as moral support, actually, and here I am.
Well, we much appreciate you being here and letting us hear what you had to say, but some of the DAs, how would you rate how much of them are engaged, like you appear to be, with drug court and directly with the judge and the families? And is there something we need to do for those who aren't engaged?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's different levels of engagement. I know that the DAs embrace the concept of accountability and embrace the concept of treatment. They really do. I've heard them all say that. It's about your community, and there's probably a whole range of commitment there. I don't want to go back to resources, but it's a combination of resources and will. And I would say that there's a whole range of those two ingredients at work in each one of your counties, and I think there is a conversation that this group can have with the district attorneys about meeting that need. That's probably the fairest way I can answer that.
That's what I need to know. Any members? Okay, thank you.
All right. I'll talk then about our planning effort here in Marion County for the mental health court. And Walt Beglau, our district attorney, has been a partner in that effort from the beginning. When I took the bench in 1999, one of my goals was to establish a way here in this county we could deal with people that had mental illness other than the traditional criminal justice model. I used to work at the state hospital. I worked there part-time while I was going through college and law school, and have stayed involved to some extent in the mental health community, just with friends that are professionals in that community. I think all of you are aware of the number of mentally ill people that are in our communities, because we have decentralized from the hospital, state hospital, certainly something that needed to be done, and moved to treatment in the community. And then we expect the community treatment people to provide the treatment
that they're overwhelmed with demand and can't provide. And so we see these folks on the street, and we see those folks perhaps acting out with breaking a window or trespassing where they've been told they cannot sleep, or stealing something in Safeway or Rite Aid. Those crimes happen all the time, and the police are called, and the question is, how can those people best be helped, number one, and how can they be prevented from continuing to take valuable law enforcement resources to attempt to meet the demand in the community for action in regard to those particular crimes. And so the mental health court is designed to deal with those people who frequently come to the jail, frequently are arrested, primarily because their mental illness caused them to, or allowed them, there is some choice involved, to make that choice to violate the law. The Seattle Drug Mental Health Court that we visited with Senator Winters earlier this year calls these people frequent flyers. That is, they come to the jail often. Sometimes they stay longer than other times, but they're regular customers. And the jail beds, as Co-Chair Burdick mentioned earlier, are so precious in these times in Multnomah County and certainly here in Marion County. And so the hope was to deal with these individuals in a way that's more effective so that they would not be frequent flyers in the jail and would also be healthier and happier in their communities. The mental health court is modeled, as is the drug court, in the form of a treatment court with individuals from various disciplines making up the team. Of course, prosecution, defense, law enforcement, treatment representatives, not only in terms of mental illness, but often in terms of addiction, because many of these people also are using drugs to self-medicate. The Marion County Jail did a survey last year, and one day they surveyed all the people inside the jail. And of that particular group on that day, 30.2% of the males that were in jail had been previously diagnosed with a mental health condition, and 53.6% of the females in the jail had been diagnosed with a mental health condition. We see in the drug court many people who have addiction and mental health at the same time. It's called co-occurring disorder in the professional treatment community. And so there's this need to reach out to those individuals in a way that we hope can be as effective as our drug court has been effective. The planning team that's been involved in this mental health court effort includes the broad cross-section of professionals who are on our drug court team, in addition to partnering with someone with housing, because those people who run successful mental health courts will tell you if you don't have housing, you're going to have the cycle just returning time and time again. We also have a constituent member who's been hospitalized many times and is in treatment now, and is an advocate for people in his situation, and is living a very fulfilled life, and is very effective on the team. We also have an informal relationship with NAMI, the advocacy group for people that have mental illness. We've reached out to the medical community through the Psychiatric Crisis Center here in Marion County. Of course, the health department is involved. And you may say, why didn't you do this earlier? The answer would be the same as why we didn't do the drug court earlier. We don't have the money to pay for treatment. All the rest of us are in the system and working. What we'd like to do is take that cost of doing business that Michael Finnegan referred to and use that time in a more effective way, and that's what we think we can do in mental health court. We expect that the individuals in mental health court will come before the judge on a regular basis, the regularity depending upon how successful they're being staying out of trouble and complying with their treatment plan. We expect that if need be, sanctions will be imposed, hopefully sanctions that don't involve a jail bed, but that would be the last on the continuum of potential sanctions that we would impose. And if we can just get treatment for these people, we know we can make a big difference in their lives and make our communities a lot safer as well. And so the dollars for treatment are the stumbling block. Well, anything you'd like to add?
Well, alongside of the meth issue, I think this issue is probably one of the most compelling public safety issues that we can tackle today. And my thought is this, is we've got to start somewhere, and we're going to start small. I'm calling it a boutique and at this point in time, because that's where you need to start when you start up a court like this. The goal is simple, and I think the judge covered it, is to enhance public safety and do something a little more compassionate and effective with those impacted by mental illness in the public safety system. That is the goal. And I think the judge highlighted the three effective tools. It's going to be the treatment component. It's going to be medications, making sure that they are available and used, and then the housing components. And when I thought through this, it's more about a court. It's really about a continuum of service involving the community. And all the way from the law enforcement, from a training perspective, and making sure that we can steer those away from the justice system with good training, through the jail system where we see those resources being used in a way that's not compassionate, and through the court system and accountability and doing something different using the wraparound model that the drug court has helped build. Although we recognize that mental health court will dynamically be different in many ways than a drug court will. So that's the bottom line. We're just getting started, and it's time to do something more meaningful. That's my my mission in participating with this process.
And I can tell you that we expect to begin December 1. We have designated a time that it will be on my docket initially, and the team has been meeting on a weekly basis. We're beginning to write some policy. Walt will again serve as a screening point for the mental health court, as he does with the drug court. He will identify people through referrals from various sources, including the police on the street, defense attorneys, perhaps other judges, people inside the jail who could be considered for mental health court. And so we're well along the way to getting it started.
Okay, what is that, Parker? You have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some states have laws that allow the courts to require somebody to take their medicine. It sounds like here in the drug court you would have a little more handle on that, but it was my experience as a police officer that I'd run into somebody, and a lot of times, you know, as soon as you talk to them, your first question would be, have you been taking your medicine? They'd want to know how you knew that. And either they felt so good, they thought they were okay, they didn't need it anymore, and they quit taking it, or they didn't like the side effects and quit taking it, and then all these things would spiral right back in. And would it be beneficial if we were to pass a law that would allow the courts to require medication, so, you know, so people would have to report every day, whatever, to some place to get their medicine so we're sure they're taking it?
I think probably the court has the authority to require that now. Although I understand the patient's right not to take medication, and I think our hope is that we can convince people who have a serious need for medication the benefits from taking the medication by providing them with the wraparound kind of services, including housing, maybe a friend in the community who comes from the faith community who has coffee with them once a week, or invites them to go bowling or go to a football game. Often these people isolate, And if we can break them out of their isolation and help them realize that their lives have value and they can contribute as well. In the mental health care, in the drug court, one of our big challenges has been helping people who are have the co-occurring disorder of addiction and mental illness not isolate. And so we've tried to get very creative in the community by finding volunteer work that they could do, sort of volunteer at my requirement in the beginning. But hopefully as they become to feel fulfilled, they will continue doing it. One particular individual in mind had some barriers in terms of just meeting people. And so we got him connected with the Humane Society, and he knows that every Friday the dogs are waiting to be walked, and they won't be walked if he's not there. And so he feels very good about the contribution that he's making.
Okay. Thank you.
Deb Cameron, did you have a question?
Yeah. Maybe this is for Walt. Talking about the financing and the creativity you're using to try to get this thing started in December and for the treatment, and how many patients or how many clients do you foresee starting out with? Can you share a little bit about how your entrepreneur skills are getting this thing off the ground?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's where we've been toiling. It's working through that. The financial component is going to be tough. We don't have any financing. But the look is that myself and the judge and the defense attorney, these individuals are coming into the system as it is, and so we might as well design a continuum of service and then identify where the gaps are and where we need financing to fill in. We do have a small grant that we applied for and received. I think it's $20,000 or $30,000, and we haven't decided how we're going to spend that. But other than that, there is no money to do this. I think I share the sentiments of the group. Is that we got to build it, begin working through it, identify the need, and then speak to the need. On the size, again, we're really starting small. We have tossed out the concept of maybe between 30 and 50 individuals in the program at any one given time. We're actually, we need to work with the court's calendar, and he does do the drug court, so that's going to be an important question as we go through this. We're planning to meet weekly at this point in time, and our team is now meeting every Friday to build the structure. Starting out, it's probably going to be about a dozen or so, but we hope to reach 30 to 50 and then go from there. I would note that I think ultimately we'll be able to handle probably more individuals in this program, just based on my experience with the range of conduct and crimes that they're committing. It's not one size fit all. We're going to focus it on the offender, and there'll be misdemeanors involved and maybe some felonies as well. We're going to focus on the individual, not necessarily the conduct, and clearly there'll be some offenses that are completely off the table, such as ballot measure 11. So that's where we're going. Maybe the judge could share a few thoughts about it. It is his calendar and his time. So
I think some of these people will have the Oregon Health Plan, and that will allow us to engage them in treatment in the community if they're not already engaged. Otherwise, I can tell you that we're gathering together the independent providers of treatment in this county either next week or the week after to explain to them this concept that we have. Those people are involved in treatment as a profession because they have a heart for it. We're going to ask them to give more. For those people who don't have the health plan and have a critical need, we'll ask if they'll each agree to take one person or a total of 10 office visits or something like that. Medication is a tougher issue. Pharmacies don't usually give medication away, and usually they're owned by multinational corporations, and so we can't go take the president to lunch and say, could you help us out here with a few medications, Mr. President. That's where we'll probably use some of the limited funds that we have. We are making applications for other grant funds. The federal government is sort of on the forefront of trying to get mental health courts started as they were with drug courts. And so we're hopeful of getting some of those monies. I expect they will take, as they have with drug courts, less of a role as more state legislatures see the benefits of drug court and provide more money for treatment. So we're looking every place.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope you'll pass this on to the absent chairs. Thank you, Judge and Mr. District Attorney. I think money is important. I thought last session we were going to have more activity on mental health. But until the state, I don't see anyone here from DHS, until DHS straightens out their distribution of mental health to the counties, we're going to have a continuous problem. They're not funding the need. They have a distribution formula that's so unfair, where one county gets $13 or something and per population, or $6, and another one gets $29. This committee, I don't think, has looked into that. It's a part of DHS. But we need to work with DHS committees and try to equalize, or not equalize, excuse me, I don't want to equalize. We want to fund the need, look at this distribution of mental health funding in the state that's controlled by DHS. And I will repeat this so it's on the record. I've asked several times with DHS and Department of Corrections, are they going to solve the problem of inmates coming out, being on their drugs for mental health issues, and then they lose 90 days until they get, you know, Medicare or Oregon Health Plan or whatever. And I've been assured by DOC that they're going to work that issue. So maybe the executive branch can be sure that's a problem that would help us with crime and everything, if we can be sure that people coming out of corrections gets their drugs until they get back on the Oregon Health Plan or something. That will help, hopefully help you and the state. So I've repeated that, I think, two times in this committee.
Okay. So was it?
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Judge Graves, with the existing drug courts and those fledgling drug courts that are in, you know, that are being put together, do you have some idea, or could you put together some idea of how much money you need for treatment and housing, that part of it? I know that we had about $5 million in grants in there, and that's been issued, and there was a request for about $10 million during that same period. Do you have some feel for, you know, we don't want to throw a huge amount of money at a situation that isn't ready to use it yet, but this is certainly, in my mind, an area that should be developed and sooner rather than later. So do you have some idea can you quantify the need and amount of money for the next biennium?
Sir, I really cannot do that. I know the Criminal Justice Commission had, I believe, $1.5 million that we as existing drug courts all competed against one another for. And I can tell you that a significant number of drug courts were not funded from those dollars. I think the problem involves not only money for treatment, but ultimately we have to have bodies who work in these drug courts. I run the drug court here in Marion County, the adult drug court, and it's one half of one day of my week. And otherwise, I'm busy handling a calendar like all the other judges. If you were to put significant resources behind in starting new drug courts and increasing the size of drug courts in order to save money, as Mr. Finnegan says our Portland drug court is doing, I think you'd have to increase the number of judicial officers as well, because I can tell you that this is emotionally very, very taxing work. You have to make an effort to develop a rapport with the individual, to remember their children's names, remember where they're living, remember things about them. And it's just something I couldn't do full time. A half day is about the max for me. I know that Judge Larson in Lane County has spent a significant amount of time in the last several years working in their drug court. I simply couldn't do that emotionally. So I can't answer the question for you. I'm sorry.
Judge Graves, I just mentioned, since I'm part of the Criminal Justice Commission, too, and DeMar, she had mentioned earlier this morning that as a result of House Bill 2485, the meth package, a portion of that was $2.5 million grant for CJC to consider dispersing amongst the drug courts, and there was close to about $10 million total of, you know, the folks out there that were wanting to be part of that. So it was really difficult to try to narrow that down, you know, for what was used. So that kind of gives you an idea, Senator, for what might be, what they could, what we would need.
I was aware of those figures, but what I was really looking at was just if perhaps some of the between now and the next session, if we could get a little more idea of the capacity to use funds, and we should perhaps prioritize those funds. I mean, I'm a climate group down there. I mean, they're doing great work, and they could do a lot more work. There's a logical, sustainable growth in this program that if we could throw too much money at, we could make everybody want to do it. And by the same token, we need to feed it as it grows. And that's the purpose of the question. So we can quantify the amount.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. And we'll recess then until about 1:30 for lunch.
We recess until 1:30. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you.
There's several of us that a little after 2 have got to be out of the room. We really want to expedite. We want you to cover what you need to, so we're going to ask you to come up and get with it. Judge Eric Bach, are you going to have anybody with you? Are you going to do it yourself?
I think we do have a representative from the National Drug Court Institute.
That's here. Fine.
Yeah.
And just state your names for the record, and then go ahead and give us your information.
Mike Leffler, I'm a fellow with the National Drug Court Institute, Alexandria, Virginia. I'm also a district attorney for Oklahoma.
And my name is Eric Block. I'm a circuit judge in Multnomah County.
Thank you for inviting me to speak to you. I will try to cut my remarks even shorter because of the time. I wanted to do three things, if I could, gentlemen and ladies. Is one, try to get a philosophical background of DUI courts, because I know that there are the therapeutic courts are alive in Oregon, and that you know about those, but the DUI court is substantially different. I want to try to talk to you a little bit about that. I'm going to skip some of the statistics that I plan to do. The second thing is I'm going to explain, or try to explain as best I can, what a DUI court is and what you can expect from that. And finally, kind of the momentum of the DUI court movement, if you will, throughout the United States. Of course, I don't need to remind you all of the damage that impaired driving does, but I want to try to set forth, if I can, the historic opportunity that I think that we have throughout the United States to really cut down on highway fatalities. Of the highway fatalities, which have been dropping over the last really 50 years precipitously, what has remained constant throughout those that half century is that 40% of all vehicle fatalities are alcohol-related or impaired-related. So as you pass on your way to your jurisdictions, the crosses on the side of the highway, if you see 10 of them, 4 of them are related to alcohol. And I know that you all probably know that, but it's interesting to note that despite safer cars, despite safer roads, despite the saturation and the good efforts of both legislators and prosecutors and law enforcement, that percentage of highway fatalities has remained fairly constant. But with all the advances in technology and jurisprudence and such that have gone to combat this problem, I think we're really down to we've cut the vehicle fatality rate so low that we really have a historic opportunity to really take it lower by attacking impaired driving. Now, I want to talk to you all a little bit about how we can do that. And I believe that, interestingly enough, if you will look at the presentation that I prepared, and I believe that is in front of you, a third of the impaired drivers, okay, a third of the impaired drivers who are repeat drunk drivers or who are high blood alcohol content, in other words, they're arrested with high 0.15 or above blood alcohol content, are the problem within the problem. Okay, they're the most serious nuts to crack. If we can stop those people from continuing to drink and drive, we can cut that vehicle fatality rate by up to 2/3 of all injuries are attributable to them, and like I said, 40% of all deaths. So let me, if I can, tell you a little bit about what a DUI court is and what you can expect. What you can expect if you go to Judge Block's program in Portland, or if you come to my program in Oklahoma, or if you go across the country, what you can expect. Drug courts have been therapeutic, and what we've always tried to do is concentrate on the offender and changing their behavior, and that is where the similarities between DUI courts and drug courts end, because DUI courts are more of a public safety issue because they have an identifiable victim or potential victims. If you see these, if you see the figures that I stated, and you see the people who continually to come back to this time after time after time, if I were to, for example, go out in the street in front of the Capitol and fire a rifle shot down the street, I would tend to think that there would be a pretty harsh consequence for that. However, if I did that time after time after time, you would expect an even harsher consequence. But these are people who we can identify who their victims are. We can identify how many victims there are annually. And these people are allowed to drive a 3,000-pound bullet down 4 miles down that same street. So we've got to marry the concept of rehabilitation with punishment. And that is something that is different from drug courts. Because what we are trying to do here, and understand, as you all probably well know, there are only four things that the criminal justice system can ever hope to do: deter, punish, incapacitate, in other words, take people away from us so that we are harmed by them, and rehabilitate. If we can marry deterrence, rehabilitation, and punishment together, that's what a DUI court tries to do. It uses coerced treatment. In other words, we force people to confront the actual behavior that is the but-for cause of their criminality, that is, their drinking or using. And let me back up and say that these people are not just alcohol abusers. They're not just alcoholics. They are oftentimes methamphetamine users. I know that you have a common problem with my state of methamphetamine use. If you survey, which we have, the people in my DUI court program, 100% of them, not 90%, not 70%, but 100% report having used methamphetamine within 30 days of their arrest. So these people often use alcohol as a crutch to get to their next methamphetamine, or in certain jurisdictions, their next opiate usage. In addition to the course treatment, that's not enough, because we have to have some kind of evidence-based belief that what we are doing is the right thing. And I'm going to get to some nationwide statistics here in a minute. But we also, okay, marry that with accountability. We have a judge who sees them frequently and periodically and monitors their progress and sanctions them for noncompliance and gives them incentive for compliance. Their usage or non-usage of controlled substances or alcohol are monitored by frequent and very well designed testing programs to make sure. It's not enough that they say they're in recovery or that they have stopped. We want to see the evidence. And so we have that there. And we have also strict rules and other things to kind of goad their behavior in a positive direction until they take ownership of that themselves. Because often these folks, these offenders, will do the least path of resistance they can take. If recovery is the path of least resistance, they'll take that. If continuing to use is the path of least behavior, they will take that. And so we've got to try to provide that path in a positive social directive, and that's what DUI courts do. Now, let me kind of finish up here by saying that it's not enough to say that this is a good thing. This is based on the drug court model, which has been wildly successful outcome-wise as you look from across the country. And Oregon had one of the first drug courts in Portland, as you know. Judge Haas was an innovator in this area. But it's not enough to say that it's good or anecdotally say that it's good. It's not enough to have someone come from Oklahoma and say that it's good. But if you look at the presentation in front of you, we are very early in this area. But all of our outcomes have been substantially positive. You very seldom see something where there is no drawback. But from some of the early evaluations from Albuquerque, from Lansing, I pulled one out for Kootenai County, Idaho, Coeur d'Alene, which I thought was most analogous maybe to the average, if you will, for the state of Oregon. They show huge reductions in recidivism. And again, these are not your barber who had a couple of drinks at the country club and got caught coming home. These are your highly targeted repeat offenders who have also high blood alcohol content, or they have high blood alcohol content, so we know that they have this problem that will continue to reoffend. So in conclusion, I wanted to just tell you that this, in the brief time remaining to me, although I will be available for questions, that this is a movement that is very analogous to the way drug courts were when Judge Haas started his drug court in Portland. It's very early in the movement, in this sea change, if you will, on how to deal with these hardcore drug driving offenders. NHTSA has recognized this and has made this a possibility for funding under the latest Surface Transportation Act. NHTSA is highly behind this, and from my talks with the people in Washington, the reason is, and I stole this from them to be honest with you, is they see the opportunity to attack this and make some really fast headway in vehicle fatalities, because you can only improve roads so fast, you can only improve cars so fast, you can only get seatbelt compliance up so fast, you can only reduce speeding so fast. But this is someplace where we can take these hardcore repeat drunk drivers, change their behavior, and we can predict how many lives that will save in the interim. Thank you very much.
Do any members have some questions? Okay, continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Block. I'm a circuit judge in Multnomah County, Oregon. I have the privilege and have for the past 3 years supervised our DUII court in Multnomah County. It's called the DUII Intensive Supervision Program, DISP for short, D-I-S-P. It's a program that was started by a circuit court judge in Multnomah County back around the year 2000, and I took over after she retired in the late summer of 2003. I have provided for you in your packet recidivism data, which was conducted of the population that's been through the program, through either by graduating or by being revoked. And as you can see, the recidivism rate for graduates of our program in terms of new DUII convictions is 8.2%. That compares with an Oregon rate and a national rate of somewhere in the 30 to 35%. So roughly one in three individuals who go or are convicted of DUII and go through what I'll call a normal probation, one third of those individuals go on to reoffend. with our population, which I would argue are the worst of the worst, the toughest of the toughest, because as Mike indicated, you're talking about the people who are the repeat offenders, the late-stage alcoholics, high blood content. I had someone in my court the other day who had a 0.43 blood alcohol content. I've had people in the program who have more than 10 DUI convictions, but have managed to space them out over a number of years so as to avoid felony charges and convictions. These are the folks that we are dealing with by and large, and with that population, we see a significantly lower rate of recidivism. The interesting thing is that if you look at the revoked participants column, people who have been through our program, benefited from the program, but not graduated, not made it all the way through, even those individuals seem to realize some benefit from participation in the program. So there's some data for you to look at, and my understanding from talking with Mike earlier is that I think we're doing pretty well relative to the national statistics on DUII court graduates. This program, as I may have indicated, is one of two DUII courts that currently exist in the state of Oregon. The other one is in Clackamas County, supervised by Judge Ron Tom. He unfortunately could not be here today, but he and I did talk about issues that he would want me to make you aware of. And interestingly, in terms of our needs list, they were exactly the same. So I'll make sure to just mention that briefly at the conclusion. We have roughly 750 participants in our program, which makes it one of the larger programs, either DUII or drug court, in the nation. It's important to understand our program is voluntary. Somebody is charged with DUII, they have to choose to participate in this program. Now, why would they want to do this? Well, for some, they truly want to get sober. They've had enough. They understand the highly negative, ruinous effect that alcohol and other drugs have had on their lives, and they want the success that this program can offer them if they come in and work hard at recovery. So some people volunteer because they want to be sober. The other reason why individuals are coming into our program, or another reason, is because in our county, the DA's office is very, very supportive of this program. And their support has translated into a doubling, tripling, and quadrupling of the pretrial offers that they are making to individuals with DUII pending charges. So if they look at somebody, let's say, who's a repeat offender and a high blood alcohol content, and it's their, let's say, it's their third offense in another county, even a neighboring county, with all due respect to them, this individual may be looking at 20 or 30 days in jail. In our county, the typical offer from our district attorney is more on the order of 120 days or 150 days in jail. And it's important to understand that in the minds, Mike made this point earlier, the addict, if you will, is going to take the path of least resistance. And if we want to coax them in the pro-social right choice for them, we have to incentivize that choice. So they do volunteer. They have a choice. It may not be a palatable choice, but it is a choice nonetheless. If they choose to come into the program, what they're signing up for is a minimum 3-year probation that intensively supervises them. It's important to understand that most people, certainly people in our county who aren't in the DUII intensive supervision program, who have DUII convictions on the misdemeanor level and in many cases even on the felony level, if they're on probation, are getting little to no supervision. They're essentially on the honor system. And that's troubling. It's troubling to me as a judge who is dedicated to promoting public safety in our program through the restoration of the individual. There are two ways to protect public safety from the drunk driver. One is to incarcerate and segregate that individual from the community. And certainly the community is safe for that period of incarceration. But certainly when you're talking about a misdemeanor charge and even a felony charge, you're looking at maximum sentences of 1 to 5 years. Absent treatment, absent promotion of these life-changing measures that will promote their long-term sobriety and encourage them and assist them in building back the pieces of their lives, absent all of that, be it 1 year or 5 years, these individuals will come out and go right back to what they were doing, pick up right where they left off. Not everyone, but for the most part, that seems to be the alternative. And so in this program, we intensively supervise our program participants. What do we supervise them around? We supervise them around their probation conditions, which are long-term treatment that begins with a full evaluation. It's very important. This population in Multnomah County was studied by the federal government between the period of 2001 and 2003, before I took over. What that federal study revealed is that in our DUII program, 65% of the men and 80% of the women have diagnosable co-occurring disorders, bipolar, major depression, and other identifiable significant mental health disorders. We need to better evaluate this DUII population because we know, based upon this and other studies, that this population carries with it a much higher rate of mental health disorders. If we try and treat the alcohol and drug problem in isolation from and disconnected from the mental health disorder, we are not spending our dollars wisely. We need to assess and evaluate the full range of problems and issues that may be contributing to the substance abuse, and then embark on a course of treatment that acknowledges and treats all of that. Our individuals are getting that assessment up front. We've partnered with a small number of treatment providers in our county who have been willing to step up and guarantee that the treatment that our folks receive will be that long-term treatment that begins with that full evaluation. Everyone gets not only group, but one-on-one counseling. And we're getting good outcomes. The people in our program who, because they've been convicted a number of times, have been through treatment a number of times, they are telling us, each and every person reports, this treatment is better, it's helping, it seems to work. So we're getting very positive feedback on the treatment. 12-step meetings like AA are mandatory at least twice a week. Scientific studies show that people who go to treatment and combine that with regular attendance at 12-step meetings increase their chances of maintaining sobriety long-term fourfold. Everybody works. Everybody has to have a full-time job, minimum of 40 hours. Face-to-face meeting with case managers. Sell their motor vehicle. Anybody who's looking at anything more than a one-year suspension of their driver's license, 3 years if it's their second or if their second conviction in 5 years, as you know, legislature in 2004 and then again in 2006 enacted legislation that made the third conviction a permanent revocation. In the judgment of this judge and our program, if you have a three-year or a permanent revocation, there is no reason why you should have a motor vehicle. We require them to sell their motor vehicle. They do. We were also studied by the federal government on this question. When somebody is required to sell their motor vehicle, does that increase the chances that they will not be driving without a license? The federal government found, yes, indeed. If they sell their vehicle, they are less likely to drive with a suspended or revoked state's license. And so that's why we do that. It's a key public safety issue for us. We make it very clear that we will tolerate them being out of jail and in the community where they can access the treatment and the 12-step meetings and all the other things that would be positive and therapeutic for them only so long as they agree to give up the driving. If they're not driving, we can tolerate relapse and what have you. If they're driving, if they own a vehicle, if they have access to a vehicle, any driving behaviors whatsoever is a mandatory jail sentence and possible revocation. In terms of needs, we have a horrendous need for greater access to inpatient treatment. All our folks pay for their own treatment, as does everyone who's convicted of a DUI. The outpatient treatment is affordable. How do I know that? Because people afford it. It's not easy for them, but if they reprioritize how they spend their money and if they meet their work obligations, everyone is able to pay for the treatment. But for those folks who, by virtue of their disease process and the extent of it, need inpatient treatment, the cost of that is beyond the reach of all the people in our program, and quite possibly all the people in this room, absent insurance, and very few people in our program have insurance. We have a 4 to 6 month waiting period for access to inpatient treatment, and I struggle every day when somebody shows themselves to be unable to treat on an outpatient basis. What do I do with them? Sometimes I'm putting them in jail, waiting for a bed to open up. It's not a cost-effective use of taxpayer dollars. It's much more expensive to pay for a day in jail than a day in inpatient treatment. So these folks need greater access. The other thing is that there's this moment of clarity when they recognize, and we recognize collectively, that they failed to get this job done on an outpatient treatment basis, and they are recognizing their need to have inpatient. We need to speed them into that inpatient setting as quickly as possible. So that's a need, and Judge Tom in Clackamas County shares that concern. The other concern we have, and you know, and I'm just throwing both these needs out there just for your information. As I said earlier, many people in our program have these co-occurring mental health disorders. Increasingly, we are detecting them because we're doing this evaluation. It's very troubling to the folks in our program to have, at long last, in many instances, at long last, to learn that they that they're bipolar or that they have a major depressive disorder, and then have no access or only a very limited duration access to their mental health medications. And I have a concern not only for them as an individual, which is real, but when they sit there and say, Your Honor, I've for years coped with my mental health problems by drinking or doing street drugs, and I feel so much better now that I'm getting prescribed medications, but my COBRA is going away, I got kicked off the Oregon Health Plan, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to manage. I know you've heard this before from other populations, but I have to tell you, to look into the eyes of this individual who is crying out for help and knows what for them is the foreseeable future without the access to the mental health meds is a very real tragedy for them as the individual, but also a public safety concern because they have demonstrated themselves as individuals who can and will engage in very dangerous behavior. Those are the two needs that we have. I want to end with one word, and that is accountability. We hold the people in our program accountable. There is two options for them. Do the treatment, do the 12-step meetings, do the work, meet your case manager. In other words, fully comply with all the things that are going to be beneficial for your recovery or suffer a consequence, and the consequence will often be jail. There are two ways. There is no third way in our program, the no treatment no jail option. It's one or the other. So we hold our folks accountable. On behalf of myself and my program and other judges in Oregon, be they DUI court judges or drug court judges, we welcome your support and we are willing to be held accountable for outcomes. We believe, based upon the national data and the data here in Oregon, that this is a model that works, that promotes the recovery of the individual, and through that recovery and restoration of the individual, enhanced public safety. If you invest in this model, we believe we will be delivering good results for the citizens of this state. Thank you.
Can we remember any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure I heard this correctly, and congratulations to you for being the newest member of the Governor's Advisory Council on DUII.
Thank you, Senator.
Your experience will be very valuable. Did I hear you correctly that 100% of your folks had, or 80% of your men and 60% of your women had a co-occurring mental disorder?
It's actually the reverse, but 65% of men, 80% of women in this population studied, the program participants between 01 and 03 had a diagnosable co-occurring disorder, yes.
And that's very common throughout the United States for larger metropolitan areas like the one Judge Block serves.
So it would seem to me that having the appropriate medication would be a part, should be a part of the program.
But absolutely.
I'm sure that that occurs.
Right. Yeah, and we do our best to get them diagnosed, to hook them up with whatever provider of these medications we can identify or seek out. You know, I had the psychiatrist over at one of our providers at the Oregon Health Science University call me with a sort of an ethical dilemma, and he said, Judge, you know, I'm kind of struggling with the reality that we're diagnosing these people, and then we don't have any way of hooking them up with the medications that they now know they need, and it's, you know, are we giving them false hope? Or frankly, is it a therapeutic plus to do that, or are we just giving them sort of another reason to be depressed about their situation? So it's a real problem.
Thank you. How many of you are supposed to be up with the speaker's office?
Okay, we're going to have to leave. Wendy, if you need to talk to me later, Senator Bray's going to take over, but get an appointment. We'll discuss the particulars.
Thank you. Oregon Law Commission. That'll be our first 2 months of session. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission, and I'm happy to be here today, even though it is something a brief time. We have a close connection. We've always enjoyed a close connection to the Judiciary Committee since the commission was funded in 2000 and was created in 1997 by the legislature to assist the assembly with law reform and lawmaking, and we generally introduce our bills through the Judiciary Committee. So to that end, as that introduction will be happening in upcoming months, we wanted to just quickly preview the bills that the Law Commission anticipates recommending to the assembly this session. But before I do that, I wanted to make a couple of comments about the commission itself, because when I left and you all left left the building at the end of session, our commission looked a little different, and I just want to note some of those changes. The speaker appointed Representative Ackerman to replace Craig Prinz at the end of session, and Senate President appointed John DiLorenzo to replace Senator Walker. The Chief Justice has changed, and so now Chief Justice DeMunis serves on the Law Commission rather than Chief Justice former Chief Justice Carson, and finally Judge Justice Martha Walters, who was one of our commissioners, has resigned her position since she was appointed to the bench. So our 13 commissioners look a little differently right now. I also wanted to note that our staff has changed a bit. We've added a person that you will recall from Judiciary Committee, Sam Sears, has joined our staff as staff attorney. So with those changes, I want to just turn your attention to what should be in your binders. I understand just a quick list of the projects that we anticipate recommending this session. You will see that that list totals 24 anticipated bills. Of that, there are 7 work groups who are working on those bills, and there are really 10 projects within those 7 work groups. Each one of these bills has its own complexities and lots of details to talk about, but I don't really want to spend your time on going through a lot of those details. I just want to highlight what the general topics are and answer any questions you might have, and also just sort of alert you to the projects that we will be addressing in case you have questions or want to talk with us in what's left of the interim to steer us in ways that you might think are helpful. I will just note generally that the first 3 on your list, government borrowings, government ethics, and Uniform Parentage Act, are all very, very large projects that have involved a number of attorneys, judges, and other interested persons and experts in their respective fields. They're also especially important because of who has requested the Law Commission look at them. The first, government borrowings, was requested by the Treasurer of Oregon as well as the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, that group of people who work on local government borrowing. So it was a request by both state and local government to fix our bonding statutes, or otherwise called borrowing. Lane Shetterly has chaired that project, and we are fixing 3 chapters on bond laws and trying to combine them now just into 2, so there will be a distinct state chapter and a distinct local chapter. We think this will make it cheaper for local governments to figure out, and state governments for that matter, to figure out what the statutes say. It will make it easier to amend, but it will make it clear what the process is for bonding in Oregon. On the government ethics project, that project was requested by both the Legislative Assembly as well as the Governor to work on a comprehensive review of the substantive ethics laws that govern all of Oregon's public officials, state and local. And I just would remind the committee that it's more than the 90 legislators that chapter covers. It covers any employee who works for state or local government. It covers all volunteers of state and local government. It covers appointed officials, as well as statewide elected and any other elected person. Basically, it covers any person who serves a local government or state government. So we're looking at that entire chapter. You'll see that there are 12 bills listed there, potential bills. We're still working hard on that project. The Attorney General has chaired this project from the beginning. He has been assisted by Greg Mao, another one of our commissioners appointed by the Oregon State Bar. We have divided that work basically into the process of how government ethics laws is enforced, and then the other side of the substantive laws themselves. So many of the bills are on one side or the other, either process and enforcement or the substantive law themselves. I could go into the details of each one of those, but as I've said, I don't think I have the time to go through all the details on all those 12. Next, the Uniform Parentage Act. This will be a familiar bill to those of you on Judiciary Committee last session. Senate Bill 234 passed out of Judiciary Committee and through the Governor's Office. And in that bill, which dealt with parentage and paternity establishment, there were a number of sunset provisions. The Assembly passed that bill with the understanding that the Law Commission would continue to look at the area of paternity law and come back with recommended legislation that would take out those sunset provisions and provide even more clarity and address even more issues than the Senate Bill 234 did last session. So we are working on and continue to work on that. The next bunch of bills are on more discrete issues that don't involve as many lots of sub-issues and things, are more discrete problems or gaps in the law. Elective share is a family law issue on what Oregon's elective share statute would be. That's the situation where a spouse wants to take against the will that perhaps were written out of the will. And it's looking at that percentage. Oregon has one of the lowest percentages in the country at 25%. And so the incentive is actually to divorce your spouse so that you'll get about 50% rather than wait till the spouse dies and you take against the will. And so it's an odd family law issue that we're working on. Moving on to juvenile law, again, has been our past record. The Law Commission has looked at juvenile law for a number of years and is trying to improve that area of law that is relatively new in terms of writing its own juvenile code, and it just needs continual updating. We have four specific issues this year on juvenile law. The first is recognizing the intersection of mental health and children's needs as well as the public safety needs. And this looks at intake, what to do with the screening information that is taken. You may find out that a child has a drug or alcohol problem, and what do you do with that information that you've learned in terms of turning it over or not turning it over to authorities in addition to their other issues they have. Aid and Assist is a project that would try to codify the constitutional requirement that juveniles must be able to aid and assist in their own defense, the same as what we have in adult courts. There's a very detailed process and substantive law analysis in the statutes for adults guaranteeing them their right to aid and assist in their defense. There's no codification in the juvenile code regarding that area, and so there resulted in inconsistencies in the counties on how that issue is treated. Next will be the Juvenile PSRB project. Those of you on Judiciary Committee last session will remember that bill did pass, but there was an amendment later in the session that took out one section of juveniles, and those juveniles who are MRDD, meaning mentally retarded or developmentally disabled. The bill still provided those juveniles with the same defense of an insanity, mental disease, or defect defense akin to the adult PSRB, but it did not provide a disposition, in other words, where those juveniles would be placed if they were successful in their mental disease or defect defense. DHS had raised cost concerns that were associated with that population of MRDD kids, and so they were taken out of the bill. But the bill did require the department to come back with a plan for those kids, and the Law Commission is working with the Department of Human Services on that issue. Next, there is the summons cleanup. That is basically what it is. It's a cleanup, but the focus is on making sure that parents understand that when they have a dependency matter or a termination of parental rights matter involving their children, that they are required to actually show up at the court of parents, and that they can't rely on their parents, they can't rely on their attorney. There are some provisions that suggest that, but it's not clear in the notice of the summons and sometimes in the orders that the judge provides, and so it's a cleanup to make sure that notice is very clear, that they're required to personally appear. There are some exceptions for personal appearance, but they have to be made ahead of that court-appointed time, and so we're cleaning up those provisions as well. And then finally, on the issue of when a parent doesn't show up, what are the responsibilities of the attorney? That's been a gap in the law, and it's been, some people believe it's clear and some others not. So there will be probably a provision that provides that a judge may allow counsel to withdraw if the parent doesn't show up. Moving on to judgments, this project's been around since I believe 2001 session when then Representative Max Williams chaired the project. It's always been one of our largest bills in rewriting, and so anytime you tackle an area of civil procedure that involves such large chapters of the ORS, there are always little things to clean up, and so we'll have another cleanup bill in the area of judgments and garnishments and judicial sales, just tidying up that area. And then lastly, out-of-bill insurance. The Law Commission got into that subject last session a bit and had five bills, one of which didn't pass, and so we're working on fixing that one up a bit, and that's the one on self-insured cars. And it would require that all cars that are on the road have the minimum financial responsibility law requirements, and that you could go to your own uninsured policy if your damages are more than that. Right now, I think most of us would be shocked to learn that if we were hit by a self-insured car, that we would not have any recourse because of how the statutes are written. And it's usually with the situation of a rented car, frankly, and the person didn't have insurance. What's surprising to know is that that rental car company has no responsibility for insurance. So it's a little fix-it type bill. And the 1548 is also just a technical fix that was, there was a mistake made last session. We just need to insert three words. So with that, I quickly ran through all 24 approximate bills. And I'd be happy to go into more detail or come back at another time if you have particular areas of interest.
Thank you very much. We're going to have a very full agenda, I can see here. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Mm-hmm. Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Johnson, did the commission talk about or consider any new laws for elections or illegal immigration?
Chair Burdick, Representative Wisman, on election law, I think the only topic that we have this session that touches on it at all would be the Ethics Project, which looks at a little bit of campaign finance law. But it's the focus is on the use of campaign funds. When we looked at government ethics laws, we quickly realized that if you're going to prohibit certain activity under the ethics laws, you have to make sure that they're also prohibited under campaign finance laws. So we did look at it as a small piece of campaign finance and election laws there. In the area of immigration law, that wasn't the topic for us this interim. It would have been requested, and frankly, this interim, our agenda was full. But it would be an interesting topic.
Any questions? Thank you. Any other comments by the committee? We've reached the end of our agenda. Our next meeting is on December 13th, and we will be introducing bills on that day in both of the committees separately. And it should be a good meeting. And if there are no other comments, we are adjourned.